Okay, we will bring the Environment Natural Resources Policy Committee to order. Representative Cornish moves the minutes of February 26th and February 27th. Representative Cornish, you had an opportunity to review those minutes. I know you have. So any questions by the members? There being none, all in favor of the minutes, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Mary Murphy's bill, Representative Murphy's bill, House File 819 will be the first file that we do today. Representative Murphy, are you here? And then we'll do Representative Metz's bill second. And Representative Metz's bill, I believe, is House File 1065.
Is that Metz?
The chair moves House File 819, recommend to pass, be referred to State Government Finance and Veterans Affairs Committee. Representative Murphy, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the Minnesota Public Facilities Authority Technical Amendments Bill, and it has a few little changes in it, and Jeff Freeman, who is the director of the Public Facilities Authority, is my testifier today.
Mr. Freeman, welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record. Go ahead with your explaining the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jeff Freeman. I'm the director of the Minnesota Public Facilities Authority, which is a interagency financing authority, essentially an infrastructure bank to help local governments finance primarily water and wastewater drinking water infrastructure projects. The bill before you is basically makes some small modifications to primarily focused on the programs that we have that are funded through the Clean Water Legacy Funds to help cities pay for or finance specific types of wastewater infrastructure improvements. This is separate from our base programs, which are primarily low-interest loans and WIF grants for affordability issues. These programs are focused on helping cities when they are required through their permit to provide some additional level of treatment over and above what they would otherwise have to do in order to meet a specific water quality goal or objective. And that was done when these programs were created through the first two. You should have in your packet a handout that's got our little PFA valve and pipe logo at the top. The first three sections of the bill focus on the total maximum daily load grant program, which was created to help cities when the PCA, through this process under the Federal Clean Water Act, develops TMDL studies, and those then lead to requirements on cities. The grant program was set up to provide 50% grants. At the same time, a separate program, the Phosphorus Reduction Grant Program, was created for when cities are required to meet more stringent phosphorus treatment standards than they would otherwise have to meet. What we'd like to do, these two programs really overlap to a great degree, and we'd like to simplify things by merging them into one program and then also expand the eligibility criteria slightly so that any time a city is required to provide this additional level of treatment for within their permit, then they could access these funds to move ahead with that project. What happens sometimes is the permit requirement is implemented, but the TMDL study hasn't yet been approved through the federal EPA process. So a city has to wait and can't get these funds until that whole process is completed. This really is about helping cities access these funds sooner so the projects can go ahead more quickly. At the bottom of the handout, the other program that we're looking at under the legacy funds is the Small Community Wastewater Treatment Program. Sections 4, 5, and 6 of the bill address this program. This is for very small, unsewered communities, 20 to 30 households or fewer, that have problems with straight pipe raw sewage discharges, serious health and environmental problems. This program focuses on helping those communities address those issues. What we'd like to do is raise there's a technical assistance grant component to that program. We'd like to raise the cap for that because these are tricky problems, and it's difficult to help find the right solution. So a little more money for technical assistance grants, and then adjust the construction funding so that the cap would be raised to $2 million, and the grant side of it would match the same criteria we use for our wastewater infrastructure fund WIF program, which is an affordability-based criteria based on per household costs. Finally, Section 7 of the bill makes some changes under the WIF program, going back to communities that received funding under that program in the years 2005 to 2010. That program is supplemental assistance when cities come to us through our loan program, but the costs per household are prohibitively high. The WIF program can provide some additional funds. Those funds from the mid-90s when the program was created until 2005 were done in the form of grants. From 2005 to 2010, the program statutes were changed to do that assistance in the form of a deferred loan. Then in 2011, it changed back to grants again. The change had to do with restrictions on our revolving fund loans and the term limit or the length of the loan term that we are allowed to fund, and trying to match up our programs with USDA Rural Development, which we partner with a lot on these funding programs. So the change was made. We were later able to get EPA to grant an exception and allow us to make changes to our revolving fund loans that really dealt with the problem in a better way. So ultimately, the program was changed back to grants. Every city now that qualifies for WIF gets a grant. In that interim period of time, 16 communities received these deferred loans. These are hardship communities that already had to raise rates to build the project in the first place, and now they're looking at having to raise rates again significantly to repay this deferred loan. So out of a sort of a fairness, we would like to apply the current grant standards and criteria back to these communities at the time they received the funding for the project and convert those loans to grants to the extent that they would be eligible for those under the current criteria. That, Mr. Chairman and members, that's a summary of the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Freeman. Are there any questions from the committee? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to speak for or against this bill? Representative Murphy, do you have any closing comments you would like to make?
I think it's a good bill, and I'm anxious to hear it in my committee.
Super. Thank you, Representative Murphy. Okay. The chair renews their motion that House File 819 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the State Government Finance and Veterans Affairs Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Next we have on the agenda Representative Metz's bill, which is bill number 1065. You want to get that? Chair moves that House File 1065 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Government Operations Committee. Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
On members. Well, I'm happy to be here today to present House File 1065, a bill that creates a Greater Minnesota Parks, Recreation, and Trails Commission. As many of you know, Greater Minnesota has long admired the extensive system of parks and trails and green space available to the citizens and visitors in the Twin Cities and metropolitan area. And the passage of the Legacy Amendment in 2008 provided Greater Minnesota a tremendous opportunity to aspire to the something similar out in our neck of the woods. So Greater Minnesota faced pointed questions pertaining to its lack of organization and its lack of plan for receiving and dispersing the Parks and Trails legacy funding it was seeking. And they told us that if given time, they would produce an organizational structure and produce Parks and Trails plan for Greater Minnesota that we could be proud of. Mr. Chairman and members, as you may already know, Greater Minnesota Park and Trail professionals are well into the development of a plan for developing a state-of-the-art system of parks and trails for Greater Minnesota. And House File 1065 represents the organizational structure necessary for the administration of the Park and Trail Legacy Funds to Greater Minnesota. Mr. Chair, I have Mr. Al Liffert here with me today to provide some more information on the bill and the initiative. And Mr. Liffert is currently the chairman of the Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Coalition and Parks Director for Douglas County.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Liffert, if you'd like to introduce yourself and continue with the testimony.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Representative Metza. As Representative Metza said, my name is Al Liffert, and I work for Douglas County. I'm the park superintendent. Alexandria is the county seat of Douglas. I'm here today representing the Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Coalition, or not to say lesser, the Rural Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Coalition, or maybe someday just the Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Coalition, which is a place that we would all like to be one day. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. House File 1065 is a bill that our group has proposed or is in support of to address primarily two areas of concern that have become apparent in the first years of legacy funding. The bill, if enacted, will solve the question of who do you talk to when you want to find out information about regional parks and trails in Minnesota, and particularly those in the cities and counties that lie outside of the metropolitan area. This bill also provides a formal commission to address one of the directives of the 2011 legislation that has become known as the 175 study. One of the deliverables in the 175 study was directed us to develop evaluation protocol and criteria to determine the priorities for park and trail acquisitions and development in Greater Minnesota. Working with the commission that's described in the bill, one representative from AMC District 1 through 9 and one representative from each of the four Department of Natural Resources regionals areas, you'll have a motivated group of individuals around the state who are fully aware of the 25-year Park and Trail Legacy Plan and its components, are fully informed of the regional park classification criteria that is detailed in the Greater Minnesota Regional Park and Trail Strategic Plan, who recognize the regional differences across Minnesota and will be able to respond to them in a structured manner that results in good decisions on legacy spending, connecting people to the outdoors, acquiring lands, and developing opportunities in coordination with our partners in the metropolitan area and the state park system. Committee members, there are 2.5 million Minnesotans who live in communities that are not part of the 7-county metro. Regional parks in these communities serve the same role in Greater Minnesota that they do in the metropolitan area, that of near-home outdoor recreation opportunities. No Greater Minnesota park agency has had the benefit or the requirement. Nope, my fingers aren't working. None of our agencies have had the benefit or the requirement to work under a statewide organization heretofore. We believe that going forward, it would be in the best interest of Minnesota to create such an organization. We think it should be a small and efficient organization, an organization that can work with counties and cities interested in parks of regional significance, and to focus on selecting projects that will produce the best outcomes for Minnesota and will align with the 25-year legacy plan. Thank you, committee and chair.
Thank you, Mr. Liffert. Does the committee have any questions for Mr. Liffert? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Metza, I understand what you're trying to do here, and but I think it's important to look at the Constitution Amendment being passed in 08, providing for support for parks. And you know, as someone representing a metropolitan district that most of the legacy money doesn't stay in the metro area for three of the four funds, I understand that this would be a receptacle to get even more money for Greater Minnesota. And I understand folks supporting their areas, but I have to support mine and I can't support the bill. I do have a couple questions, Mr. Chair. If this has an appropriation, what's the next stop on the bill?
Next stop is going to be Government Ops, Representative Panson.
And then, Mr. Chair, will it be going to a Finance Committee after that?
I would imagine it would be Representative Panson.
And then, Representative Mensa, why create in statute a 501c3 instead of creating a commission? Why the nonprofit?
Representative Mensa?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, there is precedence for this, which I'll let my counterpart here explain a little bit better for you.
Mr. Liberg.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Mensa. And Representative Anderson, we looked at a number of different ways that a commission could be organized. We looked at the enabling legislation that went into the Metropolitan Council. We looked at forming park districts. It seemed to us that there was a section on forming commissions that included the Conservation Corps and the Rural Ag Utilization Board. That seemed like the proper level of commission to make for the type of work that this group has to do. I think the fact that that it was organized in 501c3 language is to enable it to receive and disperse state funds and to enable it to receive and disperse other types of funds in a tax-exempt manner. That is, I think, the reason that it was organized that way.
Does anyone else have any other questions? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? Hearing none, the chair renews their motion that House File 1065 be recommended to pass and referred to Government Operations Committee. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
You're welcome. Thank you. Next item we have will be House File 865, and that is Mr. Sundin, Representative Sundin. Chair moves that House File 865 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Commerce and Consumer Protection, Finance, and Policy Committee. Representative Sundin, I understand that you have an author's amendment.
Mr. Chairman, yes, there is an author's amendment.
That'd be the A13-0130 amendment?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, the chair moves this amendment. To get the bill in shape that the author would like. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is approved. We now have the bill in front of us as amended. Representative Sundin, if you'd like to give us an explanation.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, representatives, this bill is intended to achieve three objectives. The first one is the environmental benefits from increasing collection of problem materials and recycling valuable resources. Minnesota has a strong network of county-operated household hazardous waste facilities, but this will expand collection opportunities to retailers and others who want to provide collection voluntarily. Carpet can be recycled into various products. Latex paint can be recycled into new paint or cement additive, and metal and other components from batteries can be recovered. Secondly, engaging manufacturers and consumers in the managing products at end of life. This moves finances from solely local government-funded programs. Managing household hazardous waste in particular is expensive, and this asks manufacturers and consumers who directly benefit from these products' sales to participate in funding the programs. Thirdly, this supports economic development and job creation in Minnesota, particularly for paint and carpet with existing recycling facilities. When California passed the carpet stewardship law, the number of facilities increased from 3 to 15, even before the law was implemented, and there are now over 250 jobs directly related to carpet recycling in that state. This legislation is needed to, number one, ensure a level playing field so all the manufacturers are participating. Number two, allows manufacturers to work together to design and manage programs. And number three, it provides accountability. These programs are in place in other places in the United States. Four states, Oregon, California, Connecticut, and Rhode Island, have enacted bill language supported by the American Coding Association. California has enacted a product stewardship program for carpet that was supported by the industry. And California also is also considering a bill this session to implement a program for primary batteries, the smaller batteries. There's an emphasis on manufacturer-created and managed programs. Firstly, it builds off the experience with other product stewardship programs in the state. Secondly, manufacturers are responsible for designing, managing, and financing these programs. And thirdly, there are requirements for adequate collection and performance goals, but those are determined in the plan. That's an overview of the plan. We have people from the American Coatings Association with me. We also have Assistant Commissioner of the MPCA, Kurt Koldelka, available for questions and comments.
Okay, if you could introduce yourself to the committee, please.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Garth Hickel. I'm the Product Stewardship Team Leader with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I want to thank you for providing the opportunity today to address this bill. First off, I'd like to recognize the engagement that we've had from various trade associations, individual manufacturers, as well as local government and others, as the bill language has been developed. It is important to note that it is one bill but has three distinct sections. There are similarities between the three sections, but some important distinctions as well. And it's designed to account for some of the product-specific attributes that obviously are only relevant to a particular product. So we are seeking to transition from a very prescriptive, regulatory-driven model to a product stewardship plan that the manufacturers develop, and there's a significant flexibility inherent in the language in terms of what that program should look like. As Representative Sundin mentioned, we do have an emphasis on manufacturer managed and finance programs, with the agency serving in a broader oversight role. The first product, carpet, is intended to address the 86,000 tons of carpet that are being disposed annually in the state. We project that the agency recycling rate is less than 10% for that material. The reason we're interested in pursuing legislation is that we did actually enter into, along with 17 other states, a 10-year agreement that expired in 2012, a national agreement to increase the recycling rate for carpet nationally. Unfortunately, based on the evaluation in several states, including Minnesota, that the outcomes from that voluntary program were not achieved. So now we are looking at a mandated program to really drive an increase in the recycling rate and create new business opportunities. There is a stewardship organization, the Carpet America Recovery Effort, that does exist in California, and we expect it to perform that same function in Minnesota. Manufacturers must participate in the program and if to be eligible to sell in the state. So that's really the kind of compliance angle, if you will. The stewardship plan outlines the collection and recycling strategy and education and outreach plan that is due in 2015. Again, that is developed by the manufacturers based on some specific criteria in statute. The plan does propose 5-year performance goals. So as opposed to several of the other bills that have been enacted for product-specific measures over the years, it does not actually have a quantified goal in statute, say a 25% recycling rate, 50% recycling rate. We feel like the industry is in a better position to be able to look at the available data, identify what those collection opportunities are, and propose what those 5-year goals should be. It is funded by a stewardship assessment that is paid by consumers. Currently in California, that is 5 cents per yard. However, that stewardship assessment is solely managed by the stewardship organization. It does not come to state government. It is important to note that the local government, recyclers, and retailers must be consulted during development of the plan to ensure sufficient buy-in and adequate level of understanding of how the program will work in Minnesota. The final plan is subject to MPCA review and approval, and there is an annual reporting mechanism. Paint is the largest volume and greatest expense for the county household hazardous waste programs. The language specifically addresses architectural paint only, so marine paint, industrial coatings, and so forth are not included. It does propose essentially the same program that is functioning in Oregon and California and will be soon in Connecticut and Rhode Island. The assessment is approximately 75 cents per gallon. Again, that assessment is remitted by the manufacturers to Paint Care, the stewardship organization, and solely managed by that organization. We expect that Paint Care will likely build on the existing household hazardous waste infrastructure in the state. However, based on the experience in Oregon and California, we expect that expanded collection through voluntary retail collection will occur. So, for example, in Oregon now, there are over 100 retailers that are providing collection opportunities for their consumers as a way to drive store traffic and so forth. Lastly, the bill addresses primary batteries, which are your typical A, AA, D cells. They are the largest battery fraction of batteries that are sold in the state. The agency estimates that there's about 100 million primary batteries that are sold in Minnesota annually, and those represent about 98% of all the battery sales to consumers. We do have an existing stewardship program for rechargeable batteries in the state that was enacted nearly 20 years ago, and so we view this as a great opportunity to complement that stewardship program. Unfortunately, as most people are unable to really differentiate between what's a primary versus a rechargeable battery, we do expect that this will lead to a significant increase in the collection of rechargeable batteries. So there's a significant environmental benefit as a result of collecting primary batteries, even outside of the metals and other constituents that can be recycled from primary batteries. There is a stewardship plan that is developed by the industry with specific performance goals, description of the collection infrastructure, and so forth, that again is reviewed and approved by the agency. However, the funding model in this case does not actually have a defined stewardship assessment. It is again managed through the sales chain by the manufacturers. And following the others, there is an annual reporting requirement. There's two other provisions that I think are worth noting. One is that the MPCA is required to report to the legislature on the functioning of the programs every 4 years as part of a broader report from the agency. And then lastly, that the agency oversight responsibilities are funded by an administrative fee that's actually based on the actual program costs accrued by the agency. And right now we estimate that it will take about 1.5 FTE to administer the bill as written. Thank you, and I look forward to any comments or questions that you may have.
Does anyone on the committee have questions for Mr. Hickel? Representative Oldham.
Mr. Chair, yes, I do have a number of questions. I hope I won't be too lengthy. As you know, I used to be a member of the American Coatings Association and a manufacturer here in the state. And I think it's important to understand that there's a few states that have adopted this, but many have not. And it's important to also understand that on the surface, this bill looks really good because we're providing recycling and stewardship. However, it's being done today. It's being done today, and it's being done efficiently by the household hazardous waste collection sites throughout all of our counties and has been for a long time. You might wonder, I mean, I talked to a number of people, and a lot of the small retailers are not here. And I know many of them personally. This bill, if you look at it, places a lot of burden on them. For instance, if the manufacturers cannot sell in this state, but the small retailer will be the collection point. Correct me if I'm wrong. The collection point. And as far as a small retailer goes, think about it. Here's a small retailer versus Home Depot or Menards or somebody like that. Everybody's going to have to take back everybody else's paint under this bill. So what would you rather do? Haul in your 5-gallon pails through Home Depot or through Lowe's or through Menards, or drop them off at your local hardware store where you can pull right up to the front door, or Hirschfield's or any of the small retail operations? I feel they'll be unduly burdened with all of this paint. And then the other thing about it is this bill says that they have to not only collect it, they have to store it. Well, retail space for small retailers is very, very precious. They have no idea how much paint's going to come in the door. And some of this paint, while I don't define latex paint as hazardous waste, some of this paint that comes in is going to be solvent-based paint. Hazardous. Okay? There's no provision in this bill for the small retailer when his insurance company goes, hey, pal, you've got all this hazardous flammable material stored in your back room. What's going to happen to him? Or when the fire marshal walks in, and I've seen it happen many, many times, fire marshal walks in and goes, you're not permitted for this. Plus, this material has to be transported, right, Dave? This is hazardous material. It has to be transported. Now, as it leaves that small retailer to go to its final destination, that truck driver has to be hazmat certified. There are very few truck drivers that are hazmat certified. This material has to be manifested as hazardous waste because that's how it is defined now. And somebody has to fill out all of that manifest. Now you tell me what retail clerk at Ace Hardware has the knowledge to do that. They don't. They have to be specifically trained. The reporting requirements for the manufacturers, while it works well for Sherwin-Williams or Behr or Benjamin Moore or somebody else like that, doesn't work too well for the small manufacturer. The small manufacturer has to report, and it's extensive reporting. So they're going to be unduly burdened by this. There's a number of other issues in the bill. I'm not going to really go into them, but I think that there's a lot of answers that have to be done here. And the bottom line is, we have a program that has worked within this state for many, many years, where you as a consumer, and I'll bet most of you have done this, where you load up the minivan or whatever, you drive to the HHW facility, and they take the paint. Now, most of that paint is already being recycled by a small manufacturer here in Fridley, Minnesota, called Amazon Paint. So it is a cradle-to-grave operation that's going on now. As far as that goes, it's not like a great deal of this is being landfilled. And one other thing about it is, if it is, and I used to formulate paints made out of dirt, okay? Calcium carbonate, silica sands, and other products like that. When it's dried, and the National Paint and Coatings Association, which is now called the American Coatings Association, used to promote a policy of that, where you could turn around and dry your latex paint and it could be landfilled because it is essentially non-hazardous. So I think this bill, there's a reason only a couple of states have adopted it, and California is pretty good at doing some things like that. I think for any outstate legislator or anyone that has a small paint store in your legislative district, I would urge you to talk to them, because I think they probably don't have a clue about this. And the thing is being taken care of now in a very adequate manner. Those are my comments. If anybody has any questions of me, I'd be happy to answer them too. But I guess really no direction or no questions from the PCA right now, or Representative Sundin. It's It's a question that I've dealt with for many, many years, and I really feel that not only the paint but the carpet thing also could be really, really tough on our retailers. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and I understand Representative Sundin, if you'd like to try to address some of those concerns there. I also want to mention that we do have a long list of people that would like to testify today, too, so I want to keep that in mind.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I'd like to respond. I've been involved in the painting industry as well for 35 years, and I truly see a need for this as well. Mr. Chairman, today we have David Darling from the American Coating Association. He's the Director of Environmental Affairs, and he can respond to most of the observations the representative brought forth and maybe clarify for us the true need for this legislation.
Okay. Mr. Darling, if you'd like to introduce yourself and then present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am David Darling. I'm a Senior Director of Environmental Affairs for the American Coatings Association. I have a couple points here, and then I will address some of the questions. The American Coatings Association is a trade association representing all types of coatings manufacturers, including manufacturers of house paint. ACA created Paint Care. It's a nonprofit organization to implement an end-of-life management program for post-consumer paint. You have a packet in front of you from a Paint Care packet. It has my testimony. It has a fact sheet. Has a number of letters of support, including Hirschfields and Valspar, two native companies here in Minnesota. This bill and the program itself was designed specifically for paint. It may or may not work for other products, but we carefully crafted this for the unique issues related to leftover paint. In our minds, product stewardship approach is one where all participants involved in the life cycle of a product take a shared responsibility for its production, sale, use, and end-of-life management. With regard to legislation, it really is necessary. The reason we're here today is that we really have to ensure a level playing field. To the point about small retailers and small manufacturers, if we didn't have the legislation, you could potentially have a very large manufacturer or retailer control the price, not incorporate the assessment, maybe try to have a cheaper product, and then could put other businesses out of essentially put others out of business. Because we have a level playing field via this legislation, we believe that small manufacturers and retailers are protected, and that's the reason for this legislation. Unless all manufacturers and retailers participate in the program and participate in a uniform manner, again, it could lead to competitive advantages and disadvantages amongst the producers and retailers. So that's why we to the point of a level playing field. We also need legislation when it comes down to the financing system like this, competitors can't talk about or agree upon the price of products or services without running afoul of antitrust provisions. Working for association, we're very careful of having members sit down in a room and talk about price. You just can't do that. It runs afoul of antitrust. The way we have this financing system and the legislation set up, it actually gives some limited protection from antitrust regulations. A quick overview of how the financing system works. A paint manufacturer pays an assessment fee for every container sold in Minnesota. That payment then goes to Paint Care. The assessment is then passed down through the chain of command or through the wholesale and retail chain of distribution so that the distributors and the retailers are made whole. The funds that Paint Care get through the assessment, they take those funds and they go out and they collect, recycle, and properly dispose of the latex and oil-based paints. We do establish collection sites. Right now you have a pretty good system of HHW. You may not have adequate collection, say, in the rural areas of Minnesota. Paint Care could come in and ask other paint retail stores to voluntarily collect paint. To the point that was made earlier, it's only voluntary. On page 12, section 12.4, any retailer may participate on a voluntary basis as a designated collection point. So it is only voluntary for retailers. If they want to get involved in the program, they can. We have 100 stores in Oregon. We have 500 stores in California that have voluntarily participated to collect paint. The reason they do that, they want to get foot traffic into the store, and it's working out quite well. Because it is voluntary, and if there are concerns about storage of flammables, space considerations, and whatnot, they don't have to accept the paint. Comes in the door. They could also refer it to another location, to an HHW, or if they feel uncomfortable with the product that's coming in the door, because it's a voluntary system, they do not have to accept that that paint. The program is currently operating in Oregon, California, and we're implementing in Connecticut and Rhode Island. In Oregon, after 2 years of operation, we have processed over 1 million gallons of paint. We've recycled over 100 tons of plastic and metal containers. And Portland, just an example, Portland saved $2 million in the last 2 years just from the, you know, shifting the paint care program, taking care of the paint as opposed to what they had to take care of. I wanted to mention, there was a question about aerosols that was brought up, and whether aerosols are going to be added in the future. The industry is really concerned about safety, cost, liability, and other regulatory issues. The other problem with aerosols is it's really not just aerosol paint. You have all types of aerosols out there, and we're just not ready at this point to manage all aerosols. If you open up aerosols, then we're going to get all the aerosols on the market. We just can't deal with that at this point. There's also a question about lacquers, varnishes, and stains, whether those are included in the program. They are. They are included in the program. Finally, in advance, thank you for your support. I'll be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Representative Babian, you had a question earlier. Go ahead, Representative Babian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Sundin, I'm curious. So we've heard of the states that have this in place. What states have had this proposal brought forward and rejected it?
Representative Sundin?
I'm sorry, I can't answer that question. I don't have that knowledge.
Representative Babian, any other questions?
Yes, if I could maybe have the other testifier answer that question, please.
Sure.
We are actually currently working in five to ten other states actively pursuing this legislation as well. Honestly, there's only a few out there that have rejected it. Most have are coming on.
Representative Babian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The fee per gallon of paint, how much is that?
75 cents.
Mr. Darling? Okay.
Mr. Chair, 75 cents.
Okay. Representative Babian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Representative Sundin, do you have a fiscal note with this bill?
Representative Sundin.
I don't believe there's a fiscal, Mr. Chairman, I don't believe there's a fiscal note prepared at this time.
Okay. Representative Babian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious to know, this is a voluntary, you said. What happens if a retailer gets involved in it and they find out that this just isn't working? I want out.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Darling?
They walk away. They say that we don't want to do this, and they don't have any more obligations of collecting paint.
Representative Babian?
One other thing. You said that there's creating business opportunities in the state. If this actually is creating, if there's a need and there's a desire and an opportunity, why do we need the state to do this? Why can't the paint manufacturers do this on their own? Why can't the carpet manufacturers do this on their own? Why can't somebody start a business in doing this and take this on? I'm curious to know, why does the state have to mandate this?
Mr. Darling?
Mr. Chair, we believe that we honestly believe that legislation is needed for antitrust provisions. We as an industry can't go out and set prices. We will come under the antitrust regulations. Again, it also gets it back to fairness and a level playing field. If not everybody's playing, then there is an opportunity for disadvantages and disadvantages in the marketplace.
Representative Babian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And have you requested an antitrust exemption?
Mr. Darling?
Mr. Chair, in the state of Minnesota, Mr. Chair, further clarification. I don't know the question.
Mr. Babian,
clarify. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Either from the state or the feds. I'm not exactly sure what the process is for an antitrust exemption.
Mr. Chair, I would agree. We found that we know that the legislation. We have actually went to outside counsel, and we found out that legislation is the best policy, the best way to do this.
Mr. Babian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm curious to know if small business, the Coast to Coast store in Roseau, Minnesota, decides to sign up for this, are they required to take paint that's not purchased in their store?
Mr. Darling.
Mr. Chair, there is a requirement that they have to essentially take in anything, but they do want to walk away. They get into the program, they don't want to continue, they don't have to collect paint anymore. But yes, we expect, let me clarify, there is such a contract. If a store wants to be a collection point as part of the program, there's a work practices, there's a standard storage requirements and stuff like that, but there is generally an obligation that they will take in all types of paint.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Urusso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to respond to Representative Uglem's comments earlier. The paint that he described would not be paint at all because it doesn't have any film forming capability. It'd be whitewash at best. The oil-based paint, it's the drying oils that are in the paint that naturally are the film-forming thing. But in latex bake, the reason it's called latex is because it has a latex emulsion polymer in it. So it's going to have things like polyvinyl alcohol. And if it's a weatherproof paint, it has some slightly more hazardous components to it. While it's wet, they become less hazardous after it dries. So it's not the dirt that it was described to be. I'm not trying to say that it's a huge scary thing, but it's not just dirt. And one of the things that struck me about the question about the solvent-based paint is, you know, there's not going to be more solvent-based paint leaving the community as waste than there was entering the community in the first place as pails of paint. And so if none of the stores in the region are handling solvent-based paint, I don't know how the people in the community are getting their hands on it in the first place. Thank you.
Representative,
Mr. Chair,
you had some questions.
I guess we could debate formulation once in a while with your technical background in mind also. And, of course, you know, once the volatile has left, the polyvinyl alcohols and things are gone. But I would like to address the voluntary aspect of this. And while it is true that a store can elect not to take back this paint, most paint is sold through a dealership organization. Okay, you go to Home Depot, you buy Behr or Glidden paints. You go to Sherwin-Williams, you buy Sherwin-Williams paints or whatever. However, many of these stores are individually owned. What I'm concerned about here is the manufacturer, and we do have the majors involved with this because it is the American Paint Association, will exert influence on these dealer stores that are individually owned to take back this paint. And this is one of the few areas left now where you really do have small proprietorships. So in other words, if you're a Benjamin Moore paint dealer, Benjamin Moore is part of this program. You may be a dealer, you may not want to take it back, but there may be some influence because this is your brand. You should take it back. The other thing that I would like to address too here is the cost. Right now the cost is going to the county. The county is bearing this cost through their HHA facilities. Now this cost is being shifted directly to the consumers, and I really think that right now the system that we have is working quite well. And also, we don't have any control over these costs here with the way this bill is written. No control at all as far as how these costs go up. And Representative Urusso, to address one of these issues about solvent-based paints and going to these small independents, that is the problem. I mean, you can have some of these solvent-based paints that weren't sold in your neighborhood, that weren't sold in your town, and they come back to you. You know, Representative Sundin, if you were involved in painting contracting and things like that, you know how popular it is to spray lacquers on custom cabinets and things like that. Highly flammable, red label products. Coming back to a coast-to-coast store or something like that, it doesn't work. That's a problem. Where it goes to an HHW facility and those people know and are trained how to handle that stuff, you're going to have some 16-year-old kids stacking this stuff up in the back of the room. It's not a good thing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cornish.
To the testifier,
What's been in your involvement? Have you been kind of the point man in other states where this has come up, or what's your knowledge of that?
Mr. Darling?
Mr. Chairman, I was involved. The key person is Allison Keene. Unfortunately, I'm kind of the backup today. I have been involved with this issue for about 15 years, so I know a little bit. I know quite a bit about this program. Came to Minnesota 15 years ago. This is one of the first states where this issue started. Worked through the national dialogue and started the program that turned into Pink Care. So I do have some knowledge of the program. Yes,
Mr. Chair,
Representative Carter.
Just a couple more questions. What if you know the number of states that have accepted? You should have more of an accurate number of the states that have rejected it. What's a more accurate number of the states that don't want anything to do with this or have rejected it?
Mr. Darling?
Mr. Chairman, it's I guess back to my answer was it's hard when, when we do, as you know, legislation is very difficult. It could, a lot of things could stop legislation. So I would say that we've had five states that it has stopped and they did not want it. Even, for example, here in Minnesota, it's been here twice, and it was, rejected by the governor.
Vetoed
twice. So, how do I put that into the equation? I'm not sure. It's hard to do the math on legislation because, how it's stopped. So,
Mr. Chair,
Cornish?
Final question would be, not that you agree with the rejections or the reasons, but go over, if you would, a list of reasons that these states have rejected this idea. What do they say that they don't like about it, in your opinion? Not that you agree with it, but what reasons are they giving?
Mr. Darling?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, I've heard issues of over-the-border sales. That has been an issue in the past. They're worried about if they sit on the border, a consumer could run over and grab it from a different state. That's been an issue. We have heard of the small entity issue before. Those are the two primary ones I can think of.
Hey, Mr. Chair,
Mr. Cornish.
The point I was trying to make, I guess, is that if there are five states rejected and only four that have accepted, and all these questions come up, and the testimony we've heard, I'm just really dubious about the bill. Thank you.
You're welcome. Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I needed to follow up again with Representative Uglum that in solvent-based paint, the solvents indeed have evaporated and are no longer in the paint when it's on the wall. But if you've got latex paint, if the polyvinyl alcohol were to go away, that paint would fall off the wall or wash off the wall. But polyvinyl alcohol is there to stay.
Representative Hackbarth.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do have some questions. I'm going to wait until some of the other testifiers come up and speak to the bill, but my questions are more centered around procedure at this point. I think I missed where this bill might be going. It was recommended to pass. Where does it go next?
The next stop for this bill will be referred to the Commerce and Consumer Protection Finance and Policy Committee.
Okay, thank you for that, Mr. Chairman. And we've got a number of different testifiers that are going to testify on this bill yet. And we have a number of bills to get to that are on the agenda. Could you enlighten the committee and probably the people that are in the audience on other bills? What's the plan for the rest of the evening?
We've got several more bills to go through. We've got House File 717 with Purcell. We've got 813 for Norns. And then we've got two bills, 742 and 731, that Representative Dill will be doing. So I appreciate you bringing this up to light so that we can continue moving along. So we do have a few more things that we'll be covering. Yes, sir.
Well, Mr. Chairman, how late are we going to go in committee? I know that Representative Wagenius' committee is scheduled to meet at 6 o'clock. Also, at the same time, the Energy Committee is also going to be meeting at 6 o'clock. There's a number of other things going on. How late do you anticipate this committee meeting?
From my understanding, we were going to go as long as necessary to complete the work that we have before us this evening.
That's my question. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, seeing no more questions, we will move on to our next testifier. This point in time, Ms. Trudy Richter, if you could come up, please, introduce yourself, and present your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Trudy Richter, and I'm the administrator of the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board. The Coordinating Board is a joint powers group of six metropolitan counties that work together on solid waste management issues, and it's been in place for almost 20 years. We do policy development, education, communication, advocacy, research, coordination, and regulation, and we prioritize products like those in front of you today. It's a collaboration. We share resources and work together. And I wanted to speak on behalf of the commissioners of the board. They would have been here in my stead. However, most are at, or some are at NACO, and others had their own county board meetings this afternoon or evening. The coordinating boards is in support of product stewardship. We were one of the leaders a few years ago when we brought paint forwards and a product stewardship option for paint. These are three important products that create a lot of cost to counties and taxpayers, and they are a resource that could lead to new jobs if they're properly handled by Paint Care and other organizations such as that. We wanted to thank the author as well as the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency for their leadership in this issue. We think it's important with the amendment that they will be including the requirement in the plan that they work with existing household hazardous waste programming, because as others have commented today, it is true the counties ultimately by state law have responsibility for solid waste, and we have had to manage these materials for many, many years. It's important to know that this will represent tremendous savings to taxpayers if it is shifted to the manufacturers to manage. And then only the consumers, not every taxpayer, whether they use the product or not, would be responsible for that cost. We would like to, in the area of paint, push back a little bit as it relates to the aerosol issue. We believe that the association could go further. We have managed aerosols for years. You put them in 55-gallon drums, you seal the drums, and they're managed accordingly. We believe Paint Care should be able to manage those as well, and would like to have that issue looked at. Again, we are supportive, though, of product stewardship, and thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you for your testimony. Seeing no questions, we'll move on to our next testifier. A pair of them will be Lisa Thibodeau and Annalie Garletz. If you both would like to come up, please, and introduce yourselves and provide your testimony to the committee, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Annalie Garletz, and I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties. I'd like to thank Representative Sundin for bringing the bill forward, and also thank the Pollution Control Agency for their work on this issue. Counties have been involved in encouraging and promoting product stewardship for years, and we are supportive of the framework for paint, carpet, and batteries put forward in this bill. We feel it's a step in a positive direction, and as we work with the product stewardship organizations to develop the agreements that are called for in this bill, we are hopeful that we can develop equitable programs and access for all counties and their citizens to promote these recycling programs. We also want to work towards, as Ms. Richter said, including more products in the future, such as aerosol paints. I will turn it over to Lisa Thibodeau to speak more in detail about where Solid Waste Administrators Association is at on this bill, and to give you an idea of how Solid Waste Administrators deal with these issues.
Ms. Thibodeau.
Hello, Mr. Chair and representatives. Thank you for hearing my testimony today. My name is Lisa Thibodeau, and I'm the Solid Waste Administrator for Chisago County. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Solid Waste Administrators Association, or SWA. I'm their Executive Board Secretary. For many years, SWA has supported the concept of product stewardship. It's just a common sense approach to designing a product to be less toxic or with the end of its life in mind, so that when you're done with it, it can be recycled and stay in the economy instead of being disposed forever and taken out of the system. As you know, the counties are charged with protecting the health of our citizens and the health of the local environment. According to Statute 115A, the Waste Management Act, and if you read the Waste Management Act, it's right at the top of the Act that we are to accomplish this protection through reduction in toxicity, recovery of materials, and reduction of indiscriminate disposal of waste, among other things. That's what a solid waste administrator does. The Waste Management Act also creates the waste hierarchy, which all waste disposal in the state is governed by. And the top of the list is reduction and reuse, followed secondarily by recycling. That's what product stewardship is. So SWA feels that this bill for the product stewardship of carpet paint batteries would be beneficial, and it would get product stewardship off the ground and running for these three materials. SWA does have questions about how this will all play out. As you know, devil's in the details, and the details of these programs will come after legislation and be worked out in the product stewardship plan. And the benefits may not be equal for all counties. SWA would also like to see other materials added to the list down the road, such as aerosol paint cans. But overall, we appreciate industry's willingness to take this on, and we are willing to trust that they and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency will take our concerns into consideration and come up with a good program that benefits the citizens of the state of Minnesota by creating more opportunity to recycle these items, by helping the local economy out by keeping these products in the system, and by helping us local governments by paying part of the cost for managing these materials. Now, my county, Chisago County, has no official position on this legislation, but our disposal costs would come down with the paint and battery product stewardship. And our landfill at the East Central Solid Waste Commission would save money on the carpet recycling. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Clark, you have Representative Johnson, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is, do I understand the county's the current waste disposal sites would still take these products?
Yes, sir, we would.
Thank you.
Okay, seeing no other question. Oh, excuse me, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, in light of that, if they are still going to take that, what about the SCORE grants then? Would we see a decrease in funding for the SCORE grants if we're not going to be handling those things?
As far as my understanding, SCORE grants to the county is about $14 million. I think HHW is maybe $500,000, so it's a small amount. My county gets, I think, about $20,000 for the HHW grant. As to whether the cost will come down, yes, my disposal cost will go down. For the first year, I would show more money in my budget. The second year, my budgeting will come down by the amount. And yes, counties would adjust either the fees that they charge, line item property taxes, or their levy dollars would come down and their budgets would adjust.
Representative Babian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And your statement that the devil is in the details, I don't think that this bill is ready for prime time based on what I know about it. My sense is that MPCA hasn't testified yet. I don't know how they're going to administer this, and they will. I wasn't here, I'm sorry. So I need to know some more of those details. I'll have to have some online conversations. So, okay.
Mr. Chair, I would just say that the bill needs to be a little bit open and flexible so that industry can, create the plan and work out the details with the stakeholders after legislation if it were to pass.
Seeing no more questions, I'll call up our next testifier, Mr. Ed Freeman. If you could please come forward, identify yourself for the committee.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you. My name is Ed Freeman. I'm the CFO at Brotex Company. We are a 90-year-old Minnesota-based family-owned business involved in textile recycling since 1923. We've been recycling post-consumer carpet since 2006 and have processed over 34 million pounds of post-consumer carpet over the past 3 years, including over 14 million pounds last year, diverting 33% of this amount from the landfill. The balance still goes back either to landfill or to burn facilities. Our byproducts from this activity go back into engineered resins and the plastics industry, and some goes back into remanufactured carpet. Carpet recycling creates jobs. We currently employ 32 people in this part of our business in the carpet recycling area. And for every 5 million pounds that we add to the processing, it creates a need for about an additional 15 jobs. If you throw away the carpet, you're throwing away the jobs. We're in favor of the proposed legislation for the following reasons. If carpet recycling is to be successful and profitable, we must collect revenue to offset the cost for taking in the carpet for processing. We have over 40-plus sites around the state of Minnesota and sites also in Nebraska, Iowa, and Wisconsin. We've got the hauling fees as well. We need to recover the cost for the disposal of the carpet of the 67% of the materials that still end up either in a burn facility or landfills. Although we have markets for the materials that we extract from the recycling of the carpet, the cost of the waste stream still represented $370,000 for us last year. We're doing everything possible to reduce our internal costs, improve manufacturing efficiencies, maintain the sales margins, but we're struggling to make the business profitable. We're working towards possible uses for waste in the plastic soil applications and for other markets in development. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no questions, we'll move on to our next testifier, which would be Ms. Molly Peterson. If you'd like to come up, please introduce yourself. Molly Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Molly Peterson, Government Affairs Director for Conservation Minnesota, and I am here to testify in support of House File 865. For Conservation Minnesota, we view this as an extension of the work being done in previous years that have dealt with problems in the waste stream, like electronics waste. Too often, products like carpet, paint, and batteries end up either in landfills or, in the case of paint, dumped down the drain by consumers simply because they aren't aware of any other options for disposal. And simply by our name being Conservation Minnesota, we get a lot of calls at our office from consumers, from Minnesotans who say, you know, what do I do with these types of things? Is there a take-back program? What can I do? So we really do believe that Minnesotans want to do the right thing by responsibly disposing of or recycling these types of products. And we do think that the provisions in House File 865 will lead to less materials ending up in the landfills and in our wastewater. And we appreciate Representative Sundin's leadership on this issue. We appreciate Mr. Hickel with the Pollution Control Agency working with the stakeholders. And I thank you in advance for your support.
Very good. Representative Ugel.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that consumers dump paint down the drain. What evidence do you have of that?
Ms. Peterson?
Well, we do get calls from us to our office of people who say, you know, is there anything that I can do? Do I dump this down the drain? Is it safe? So we have gotten some calls from that.
Mr. Chair, so you get calls, but you have no evidence that people are dumping it down the drain, no firsthand evidence?
Ms. Peterson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't go to their house and see if they've done that. No.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next on the agenda, we have Marcus Bullish. If you'd like to come up, please introduce yourself to the committee.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'd like to defer to my colleague before and reverse the order, Mr. Kohorst, if that's allowable.
That would be fine. Mr. Kohorst, if you'd like to come up, please, and start off the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Mark Kohorst. I'm Senior Manager for Environment, Health, and Safety with the National Electrical Manufacturers Association. I appreciate the opportunity to address you today. NEMA is the principal trade association representing the interests of the U.S. electrical products industry. I'm here today on behalf of several members of our primary battery manufacturing section, specifically Energizer, P&G Duracell, and Panasonic. I'm joined by one representative of one of these member companies, and he'll speak to you directly in a moment. I'd just like to speak broadly on the motivation for this bill and the context surrounding it with respect to primary batteries. First of all, I want to reemphasize again that this section of the bill deals with primary single-use batteries, not the rechargeable batteries used in power tools, phones, computers, and other devices that we have to charge up for further use. These are primarily so-called alkaline and carbon zinc batteries, the AA, AAA, CD, 9-volt, that are ubiquitous in our households. I want to begin first by noting that battery manufacturers voluntarily have taken major steps to address the potential human health and environmental concerns associated with these products. The biggest and most significant is two decades ago, the primary battery industry was the largest industrial consumer of mercury. And that's because all of these these household batteries, C, D, AA, and AAA, contained a sizable measure of mercury in them. At that point, however, the manufacturers were able to develop technologies that eliminated the need for mercury in these batteries. A few years after that, mercury addition to carbon, zinc, and alkaline batteries was made illegal by a federal 1996 federal battery legislation. The only batteries left today that contain mercury in the consumer sector are the miniature ones, small button cell and coin cell batteries that power hearing aids, small tools, watches, and other small devices. Our members, NEMA manufacturers, have committed to eliminate mercury in those batteries by January 2015, and they're well on course for meeting that goal. This bill today, H-865, addresses another important sustainability issue, and that's the proper management and disposal of primary batteries at end of life. We appreciate PCA's focus on this issue, and we've begun working with them on changes to the bill that reflect our industry's considerable knowledge of the issue, obtained mainly through a nationally focused initiative that's been underway for several years. My colleague will explain this effort more fully in a moment. I'd like to stress, however, first, that this model, this approach that we're working on, is intended to be applicable to primary batteries only. This is not a generalizable product stewardship model that we think can or should be adapted to other products. Our view, NEMA's view on this, is that all products and the markets they're traded in are distinct, and they need to be viewed as such in policy discussions. So finally, I'll just say that in working on this language with PCA and the model that applies to primary batteries, we have three principal core objectives. The first is to ensure a level playing field. In other words, address the notion of free riders. Secondly, and this is closely related to the first objective, the program established by the law needs to be economically sustainable for the manufacturers, and that will be aided by establishing this level playing field I just mentioned and ensuring that all or most of the stewards, the parties that are responsible for putting batteries on the market, are involved in the program. And finally, we're seeking to ensure that the program is structured to ensure that these batteries are collected and processed in the most environmentally protective and efficient manner. As my colleague will explain, NEMA has explored collection methods and recycling technologies globally, and we have a lot. We've developed a lot of collective knowledge on that issue, and we bring that to the discussion here. So, in summary, the companies that I mentioned are very supportive of the effort to craft a collection framework that will work for the state of Minnesota that meets the goals I just mentioned. We hope very much to reach agreement with PCA on those objectives. So that concludes my testimony, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kohorsch, you may not be in a position to answer this, but I'm hoping that someone can. You mentioned the button and the coin batteries. Having worked with four different assisted living and nursing home situations and seeing aides throw button hearing aid batteries away willy-nilly, literally, it just goes in the trash. So my husband and I started collecting them so mm-hmm. that we could recycle them. We were not able to get any of those facilities to establish a way of collecting them. And you can imagine how many they go through.
Yes.
Is there anyone who is addressing that? Or has, it's been a couple of years, has someone perhaps started a program to recycle those?
Mr. Kohorsch.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ward, the good news is virtually all of those batteries now, and the technology is called Zinc Air, are mercury-free on the market. So virtually all that you buy now have no mercury. For our members, that's the case. There are manufacturers that are not NEMA members, and so there may be some that still contain mercury. But for the most part, the ones you buy in most retail stores should be mercury-free.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, perhaps I misunderstood. I thought you had said that 2015 would be the year that the button and coin batteries would be. Those are the batteries I'm talking about being thrown away. Hearing aid batteries in great quantities. And are there other materials besides mercury that we should be keeping out of the landfills that we should be collecting with these batteries, even if they don't have mercury in them?
Mr. Crawhurst.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm sorry if I wasn't clear. There are several types of miniature batteries. Zinc air is one of them. They are the primary technology that is used in hearing aids, and that particular technology is virtually entirely mercury-free now. Some of the other chemistries that go into things like watches or toys, the industry is not quite fully there yet, but we will be by January 2015. But the ones you're talking about, I think we can almost assure you are going to be mercury-free when you buy them. And in terms of whether there's anything else in them, I think in those particular batteries, no, there's nothing of concern in them.
Okay. We'll move on to our next testifier then. Can you introduce yourself to the committee, please? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Mark Boolish. I am the president of the Corporation for Battery Recycling and also the director of regulatory affairs for Energizer. I promise I will be brief unless there are lots of questions. Our industry conducted a life cycle assessment on our batteries a few years ago. There have been others that were done out of the European Union. Like the European Union studies, the LCA showed that the current infrastructure for collection and recycling of primary batteries is a net negative for the environment, mainly due to the extreme amounts of energy that are used to disassemble the batteries. But unlike the previous studies that did not look at that, our study showed that there is a window of opportunity that if we carefully craft a program, we can get to a point where it's environmentally positive. Because of that, we had always said within our industry if it made environmental sense, we would step up to the table, and we're doing that now. Our company presidents have given us approval to move forward with the creation of a program. And part of that program involves testing and learning so that we can develop a program to get or at least have a window to that environmental benefit. One of those programs that we've been testing and learning with is located locally here as Hennepin County. We've been actively funding a portion of the Hennepin program for over a year now. Our program was originally intended to be voluntary, but because we've come across a significant portion of free riders in the market that would make it inequitable and unfair for the members of the Corporation for Battery Recycling, we are moving towards trying to get a legislative fix for this. And we are working with MPCA, and we are certainly hopeful that we can reach a consensus with them that will work in Minnesota. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have. And real briefly, the miniature batteries that Representative Ward mentioned would be part of this program.
Very good. Thank you. Seeing no questions, we'll move on to our next testifier, Mr. I believe Tony Quilis. Quilis. And Genevieve Davila. You would like to come up and introduce yourselves?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quilis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I will be brief, and I'm glad that Genevieve came down, and there is also a representative from the carpet industry here too, Mr. Chairman, that I'd like to cede my time to. But it shouldn't be shocking to you that the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce supports voluntary programs to educate manufacturers, retailers, and consumers at various stages of the product lifestyle. Want to show you that our willingness to participate and lead in waste management issues here in this state is we have an affiliate at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce called Minnesota WasteWise. It is an award-winning program that has over 640 companies involved in it, and its goal is to reduce waste, save costs related to waste management, and then try and find the end products of one of our members, whether it be cardboard or plastic packaging peanuts, and try and find, instead of disposing those, but trying to find someone else
else that has a use for those. So we try and match those up, and we've been successful in doing that a couple of times. Their motto is less waste is smart business. And finally, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to turn away and turn over to Genevieve and somebody from the carpet industry. In this discussion and deliberations, as you talk about waste management, keep in mind that each product is unique, and you can't do a one-size-fits-all. Electronics are different than carpet. They're different than paint. And even within the batteries, I think you're going to hear, and you've heard some discussion here today about rechargeable batteries versus primary batteries versus button batteries, batteries in toys. And I think you're about to hear from Genevieve. And if we keep going at all this pace throughout the next couple of weeks here before committee deadline, that pacemaker that I'm going to have to get in my heart is going to have a little battery in it. And Genevieve's going to talk to you about that. So, I mean, just keep that in mind in your deliberations as you go through it. It's really hard. You can't boilerplate this. You have to look at it as each product is unique. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to turn it over. Stand for any questions and turn it over to Genevieve.
Well, Mr. Close, I resemble that remark regarding the pacemaker. Those batteries are very valuable to me. Go ahead, Ms. Deep.
Mr. Chair, members, Genevieve DeVilla, I'm with Life Science Alley. Life Science Alley represents the medical device industry here in Minnesota. We have nearly 700 members, ranging from 3M, Medtronic, St. Jude Medical, to the smaller startups and mid-sized firms, as well as the suppliers and the manufacturing side as well. Our members are committed to providing safe and effective products, as well as being stewards of the environment. We are concerned specifically on the section regarding batteries. Imposing specific requirements on product manufacturers could require changes to product labeling or packaging, which in the case of medical devices would need to be approved by the Federal Food and Drug Administration. In order for the FDA to uphold its stringent safety and efficacy standards, a huge amount of clinical data is submitted to assure the agency that that product and the processes of manufacturing that product can be created in a way that guarantees the public that they will not be put at risk. Quality control procedures are extremely important to show consistency of the products in design as well as function. We are concerned that unless exempted, the bill could have significant negative consequences on the product approval process. It is our understanding that the definition of primary battery is being worked on by the authors and the MPCA and other stakeholders, and we are looking forward to being a part of that discussion. Any changes to the final composition of our products, including batteries within those products and the packaging or inserts, or labeling for that matter, that details in the requirements of this bill could require further approval from the FDA. Once again, our members are committed to the promotion and the use of environmentally responsible materials, and we thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. I represent Isaacson.
Oh, no, I was just... No, thank you.
Okay, I'm sorry. Any questions here for Mr. Villa? Okay, welcome. Introduce yourself to the committee and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Gail Kulik, and I'm speaking today on behalf of the Carpet and Rug Institute, or CRI. Jennifer Mendez, the Vice President of Government Relations for CRI, could not be here, but her testimony will be sent to you. CRI has a commitment to recycling and reuse of post-consumer carpet. CRI was instrumental in the formation of and still actively participates in CARE. You heard a previous testifier, Mr. Hickel, refer to CARE, C-A-R-E, that's Carpet America Recovery Effort. Since 2002, CARE has facilitated the diversion of 1.6 billion pounds of post-consumer carpet, most of it by recycling. You also heard from Mr. Ed Freeman of Brotex, a Minnesota carpet recycler. And we're proud to say that CARE has had an impact through him because Mr. Freeman and his company, Brotex, is a member of CARE. The California legislation, Carpet Stewardship Law, did not have the level of collaboration that ends up with the most successful sorts of programs. The kinks haven't been worked out. They don't know how they're going to address rural collection. It's not clear that our industry can operate a successful program under this bill. Someone has said the devil is in the details, and that's true. Everyone wants a program that works. and let's learn how California is going to work it out. They will have successes and they will have failures, but we'd like to leave the failures in California and bring the successes home to Minnesota.
Questions for the former member of the House of Representatives? There being none, anyone in the audience, thank you, anyone in the audience to testify for or against the bill? Members, do you have any questions? Representative Hackbart.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members. Well, I do have one question. Mr. Eloff could answer this question for me. A number of years ago, we did one of these recycling things for paint. And is there something in statute now where we, where there's a tax or a fee on paint that's hidden in the price? Or I thought we did something like that already. Maybe something that went to the counties that for recycling paint. Is there something in statute that you know of at this time? Or maybe the department can answer that question. I don't know.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hackbarth, I certainly don't recall anything like you're describing. What I remember is the effort to do an industry-based collection program for paint that was and did get vetoed by the governor.
Oh, okay. Yeah, maybe that was it. Maybe something did get passed and then it got vetoed. Okay. Well, thank you for that. And Mr. Chairman, I'm a little bit concerned. Every single day I come in here, I'm finding out about a new tax or a new fee that's being proposed in these bills. I'm finding out that there's a huge liquor tax that's being proposed, a cigarette tax. Every time we come in here, there's a new tax or a new fee that's being imposed somewhere. I mean, it's just getting ridiculous. And that's what this is. This is just another fee on consumers. We've got programs in place that are working. I have not heard of any complaints at all about being able to recycle any of these particular items. I think this is a solution looking for a problem. And, Mr. Chairman, I think this is a very, very, very bad bill. I think this is something that should be brought to the attention of our voters, and I'm going to ask for a roll call vote.
Okay, roll call has been requested. Representative Hackbarth, I absolutely have to agree with you. In fact, during the last 10 years under the former governor, almost $3 billion in fees were assessed to the general public in fees. So I absolutely agree with you, and we're not doing much better. So, Representative Sundin, anything further on your bill?
Mr. Chairman, to the bill, thank you very much, Vice Chairman Fisher. And Chairman, this is nothing new or earth-shattering for Minnesota. We've recycled tires. We've mandated the reuse and recycling of tires. We've mandated the reuse and recycling of car batteries. We've had a couple of businesses here that have testified or been mentioned, Botex and Amazon, that are already in this industry. We can actually lighten the load on the government burden if this program is implemented. This is our responsibility in regards to environmental stewardship, and I thank the committee for their consideration. Thank you.
Representative Hackbarth, thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Sundin. We're already doing this. We're already recycling these items. There's already laws in place that say that we need to recycle our carpet. There's already laws in place that say that we need to recycle paint, and that the counties are providing these things for us already. I think we're doing a good job at product stewardship in a lot of different ways. There's a whole new ball game on the way we're going to be doing those things. I just see this as an expansion of more bureaucracy. We're hiring more FTEs to handle these things. Representative Fabian, the last couple of years, has had legislation to reduce the bureaucracy and make things simpler and easier. This makes things more complicated. So I just don't see a need for this. We see more and more of these bills all the time, and it's just getting carried away. And Mr. Chairman, you know that I carried the increase for the hunting and fishing licenses last year. That's an increase in fees. I believe that fees are you pay as you go, Mr. Chairman. Taxes are things that are imposed on people that don't necessarily are things that you need or that if I participate in hunting and fishing, that's my prerogative, and I should expect to have to pay for a license to do that privilege. Taxes, I think, are another issue and in a whole other category. So, and we're talking about fees, I think it's a pay-as-you-go type thing as opposed to a tax.
Well, thank you, Representative Hackbarth. And Representative Benson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and you've been very patient, and so has the Vice Chair. All I can say is last time I dropped off cans of paint and some oil and so, I went to the Hennepin County, I think it was in Bloomington. They didn't charge me one penny, but I think I had to pay something on my property tax.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah. So let's really have the people who produce this and the people who use these pay for it instead of putting on my property tax. And I'm surprised that people who don't think a government should go want the government to pay for all this. So let's stand for the consumers and for the taxpayers instead of the producers of all these products, Mr. Chair.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Hackbarth.
To that point, Representative Benson, I don't think that you're going to see your county taxes go down because we adopted this program. I don't think they're going to take that into consideration.
Representative Benson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. It'd just be one less reason for these Democrats to want more taxes. They'll have you'll have a stronger argument now.
Representative Bugle.
Mr. Chair, I just would like to call, besides the tax thing, I would just like to call everybody's attention to the fact of safety. The HHW facilities are accustomed and know how to handle these things. They're hazardous waste facilities. They understand when they get a product in there in a paint that is a red label flammable product. And I'm afraid that going to these small retail stores or other places, I know that these young clerks do not have the training to handle this stuff. And I'm concerned about that. I think the system that we have right now works well. Works well. And there's nothing to be saying that, you know, in the future, if the American Paint and Coatings Association cleans up some of the things in this bill, then we couldn't consider it again. But we do have a safety issue here that should be considered. Thank you.
Representative Urizo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One thought on that might be that before this goes to another committee, someone could think about whether there could be language added that restricts the acceptance of solvent-based coatings to designated stores that are equipped to handle it. Because I actually do agree with you on this on the solvent issue, because half-filled cans of solvent-based paint are more hazardous than full ones. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any further comment? Oh.
Mr. Chair, as the new representative on this committee, I come here partly looking for new ways of approaching governance. And it strikes me that this is a new approach, and that the industrial partners are working with PCA to reach a common goal that we all have for safe product disposal. Thank you.
Any further questions on this? The Representative Fisher renews his motion that House File 865, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Commerce and Consumer Protection Finance and Policy Committee. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Fisher?
Aye.
Representative Benson?
Aye.
Representative Cornish?
No.
Representative Fabian?
No.
Representative Green?
No.
Representative Hackbarth?
No.
Representative Hanson?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Isaacson?
Aye.
Representative McNamara? Representative Purcell?
Aye.
Representative Uglum?
No.
Representative Wagenius?
Aye.
Representative Ward?
Aye.
Representative Yarusso?
Aye.
Representative Dill?
No.
Nine yes, the motion prevails. Okay, we're going to take just a second to get organized here, and then we're going to do the Purcell bill next.
We do. I think some people are clear now.
Did he?
Yes, he's dead, yeah.
Right? You go.
So when's the party?
Yes, exactly.
Peter, I'll be right above us. So calm me down. Need me to vote. Yeah. Standard Norton, 612-600-5778.
Chair, come on.
I don't know, they just want me to show up. So I can, whoever in the audience will let go. So I'm going to go. You can go over there and run at 6 so I can get it right away.
I mean, I look there.
Is that? Well, don't worry about it.
Hey, Molly. Hey, Molly. Good. I was going to say to him.
Okay, folks, if you're going to have conversations about the last bill, if you could please go outside, we're going to try and keep on track here. All right. Representative Purcell, your bill is House File 717. And Representative Purcell moves that the House File 717 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. The bill has an amendment, and it is the A130126. We'd like to adopt that to House File 717 to get the bill in the shape the author wants. Representative Purcell moves the A130126 amendment. Discussion on the amendment, there being none. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Motion prevails. To your bill as amended, Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm going to have a couple of effective dates to get into this bill as well. If I can do that now, or do you want to talk about the bill first?
No, let's get it totally the way you want it. So you have an oral amendment then?
I do, and I've talked with Ms. Taylor, and I may need some help with this, but I'll give it a go.
Representative Purcell.
Got an effective date on the on the bill as amended after section 1, line 1.23. It'd be an effective date of January 1, 2014. After. Okay, and I'm going to say this, and if I mess it up, after section 2, the effective date, January 1, 2014, and this is probably not going to sound, we have to renumber this thing. Am I messing it up already, Ms. Taylor?
Representative Purcell, you just tell us what you want, and Ms. Taylor will get it taken care of for you.
I need 20... ATV 2014, Watercraft 2015, January 1 in both cases.
Okay, Ms. Taylor, could you tell us where that fits in the bill and how it's going to look when the bill is amended with the Purcell oral amendment?
Sure, Mr. Chair, members, what would happen is on after line 1.22, an effective date of January 1st, 2014 would be added. It would read effective date period. This section is effective January 1st, 2014 period. And then also on the bill after line 2.21, another effective date would be added. This one would be read effective date period. This section is effective January 1st, 2015, and this one is, applies to the watercraft. And then if you'd go to the amendment that was just adopted, you'd go to line after line 1.25 and add effective date period. This section is effective January 1st, 2014 period.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Questions on the Purcell oral amendment? Being none, in favor of the oral amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion prevails. All right, to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence. Ms. Taylor, members, the Leech Lake Band, along with other tribes in Minnesota, is requesting Minnesota recognize the tribe's authority to license ATVs and watercraft. This was done for snowmobiles in the last session of state legislature, and it's just seeking to put this on to ATV and watercraft. Worked with a number of folks and fellow legislators in getting this together here. Thanks to Representative Hackbarth for his help on this, and I have with me today too Mr. Henry Erdman, who was doing some work with the Leech Lake Band, and he'd offer a couple of words on the bill.
Okay,
Mr. Erdman.
Mr. Erdman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Henry Erdman today here on behalf of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. We support this legislation, appreciate your time, and we will work with the DNR on ironing out some of the details involving the Coast Guard on watercraft licensure going forward.
Questions for Mr. Erdman from the members? There being none, Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, really quickly, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. The reason for the delayed effective date on the watercraft is we do need to get a system developed or approved by the Coast Guard. So this, we feel, should give us time to get that approval process taken care of. If not, we have a commitment from the Senator, Representative Purcell, and the supporters of the bill that work with us on that effective date to make sure it works with the system.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is to the author, Representative Purcell, on where you have the 30 days outside the 30 consecutive days outside the tribal reservation boundary. How is that monitored?
Mr. Erdman or Mr. Representative Purcell?
I'm going to defer here and how that would be monitored, I assume, by conservation officers or, you know, anybody that's out there.
Would our chief of enforcement like to come down and discuss that at all? Based on his body language, I'm thinking no, but he is coming down. Welcome, sir, again, if you'll introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the record. Lieutenant Colonel Rodman Smith, Assistant Director for DNR Enforcement. Mr. Chair, for the monitoring of, and Representative Fabian, for the monitoring of the 30 days, it wouldn't be no different than any other watercraft or recreational vehicle that is licensed by another governmental agency, whether it be Wisconsin, North Dakota. We monitor those basically on a complaint basis. We don't have the staffing to mark vehicles that have been outside of another governmental agency, whether it be Wisconsin, North Dakota, or in this case, the Leech Lake Tribal Reservation boundaries. So it'd be basically on a complaint basis. The officer would probably do some interviewing to find out.
Representative Fabian. Nope. All right. Thank you very much, Lieutenant Colonel. Representative Buechlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Purcell, is there a fiscal note needed for this? Because I'm assuming that we'll see some decreased revenues at the DNR.
Representative Purcell.
I haven't asked for one yet, but I certainly can.
Representative Buechlin, we don't believe one is required. Mr. Meyer, are you here still? Thank you, Mr. Meyer, for coming up. Can you shed any light on that particular question of Representative Buechlin?
Mr. Chair, members, I don't have any ideas of what the numbers of registrations may be. We did not prepare a fiscal note when the snowmobile registration bill went through. It'll be minimal at best. So we can try to figure out what that might be, and if a fiscal note is requested, we will work on that process. But I don't have any numbers right now. I don't. it'll be minimal compared to the number of registered machines that we have or boats that we have out there. So,
all right. The testimony is that it's minimal. Further questions for Representative Purcell on House File 717? There being none, anyone in the audience like to testify for or against the bill? There being none, Representative Purcell renews his motion to recommend a pass and go to the general register as amended. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The next bill will be House File 813. Representative Nornes is here. The chair will move House File 813 for Representative Nornes. And Representative Nornes, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's been a long day, so we'll make this as brief as we can. The area that I represent, like others, is being invaded by the little rascals, the zebra mussels, and other invasive species. And so I understand why we're concerned about that and why we require a permit now for some folks that are working with docks and lifts. This bill, however, comes to me from the resort community, where they believe that by having this training and the proper permits, the resort owner and operator, that should exempt anyone they hire to help them install or remove a dock in the spring or the fall. They would be there just as a temporary employee during the time it takes to roll it in or roll it out. And so this bill basically provides for that exemption for those part-time employees. And I've got Joel Carlson from the Resorters Association, also the DNR. If they want to speak, they sure can. And they'll be brief.
Question, Representative Viewers, so you have a question.
Yes, well, it's kind of a technical nature. I'm aware of at least one resort in the state that has frontage on two different lakes. So my question would be if any of those resorts that might have frontage on two different lakes have zebra mussels in one lake and not in the other, or some other invasive species in one lake and not in the other. And whether we would need to be careful about that.
Representative Russo, the way I read the bill is it affects only those docks or related equipment that would stay at that location, and they couldn't if they were transferred to another lake. So if we had Lake A, Lake B, and we took it from Lake A over to Lake B, then this bill would not govern that. Representative Russo.
Well, it says stay on the property owned by the resort. If it's all one property, that's what I'm worried about.
Oh, so you're okay, Representative Russo. I see you got a piece of land. On one side is one lake, one side is the other lake, and it's all owned by one resort. Interesting question. Mr. Carlson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I own a government affairs business in St. Paul, and I'm here on behalf of the Congress of Minnesota Resorts, which is an association of small family-owned resorts in Minnesota. And we appreciate the committee considering this issue. And Representative Russo, just your point is well taken, and it's an issue we have talked with the DNR about. And we're looking at a suggested change to the language that would require the equipment to go in and out of the same water body. And so it's a point well taken, and I don't think we have opposition for this concept from the department, and we are just making sure that we get the language in a way that works for everyone, and we will address that issue as well.
So if we can just take a short break, because I'm having Ms. Taylor work on an amendment to address that very perceptive nuance in this bill. So if we can just take a couple of seconds. Ms. Taylor is going to work on that. I don't know that we'll be successful. And also, Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, the DNR had suggested some language that they had shopped around to us, and he may have that there for you. These iPads are amazing things, aren't they?
You know, members, the reason that we have these committee meetings is exactly for this reason, that we have a vast array of people that are experts in many different things and see these their strengths or weaknesses. And I really appreciate the fact that when, like Representative Russo, I read this five times and I didn't see that, but I didn't think about the fact that resorts between two lakes?
I happen to have spent time at one of those resorts that was. That's the only reason I know about it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And so we're working on the language, if we just take a minute. We'll just recess for 5 minutes. That way, if people got go do their thing, we can do it. 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are you on environment? Finance as well?
Your night's almost done.
Yeah. I hope. But you got to go up there?
Yeah.
Or down there? Wherever?
Sure. Yeah, down there. Tuesdays I'm normally 7 o'clock.
Tom, you aren't on finance?
I am four.
This is fine.
Your point was, I appreciated that.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's technically for and I may have gotten in a little trouble with quitting the city. This quarter city.
Oh, yeah.
This is one of the few nights that I don't have something going in the last couple of weeks.
I'm stretching the zone a little ways from the quarter.
Really? Yeah, I'm going to have to
call the committee tomorrow. I thought.
Can't be everywhere.
He's going on a medical leave.
Pick your poison.
He's got a problem with his surgery coming up, and I think he's going to be up there.
Well, the mayor was going to be gone too for a while, and he mentioned it, but I didn't.
Well, he sent an email and kind of went generally to the council.
I didn't. You know, I don't know where this is going to go.
Yes.
And council hasn't really given me any real authority to do this. I just thought, for the discussion purposes, if we get a chance, you know, let's talk about it. We're competing, especially with North Dakota. I wouldn't have put any money on it.
Yeah, you can't.
I don't know. If we get out of here in time, it'll be snack.
We'll come out of recess, and we'll retake up House File 813, the Nornes bill. The bill is already before us, and Representative Nornes has an amendment. So Representative Yaruso will move the amendment to House File 813, and Representative Ms. Taylor will read the amendment for the committee. Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members, the amendment would read on line 1.17, delete remains and insert remain, and then after resort, insert and are only removed from and placed into the same water of the state.
Questions on the amendment? Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and members, the language that the DNR had provided to us earlier today also struck the language on 1.18 and all of 1.19. So the net effect of that is that a service provider that is doing this on their own property and in the same water body would, you know, their employees would not have to do this. That's not our fight. I'm just telling you that that's the language that the DNR had provided to me earlier.
Mr. Meyer? Mr. Meyer, did you hear the language that Ms. Taylor spoke regarding, and maybe Ms. Taylor, if you'll repeat the language, please, of the amendment to House File 813.
Sure. Mr. Chair, committee members, on line 1.17, delete remains and insert remain, and then after resort, insert and are only removed from and placed into the same water of the state.
Mr. Chairman, members, that language works. I've also sent Ms. Taylor a copy of our actual amendment that we can continue working on this piece, but that meets the requirements and the questions that came up on this section right now. So we do support the language as well.
All right. Further questions on the bill as amended? Oh, I'm sorry. We have to move the amendment, the oral amendment, as described by Ms. Taylor. All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. And now, any questions by the committee for Representative Nornes or Mr. Carlson? There being none, anyone in the audience like to testify for or against the bill? There being none, I'll renew my motion that the House File 813 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register as amended. All in favor of the bill, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much.
Go fast. As amended.
Good afternoon, Representative Dill.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and I'd like for you to move the bill, House File 731, be recommended to pass and sent to the Environment Finance Committee to Government Operations. That is my motion.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Dill and Representative Dill, and we have that. And then you have an author's amendment?
I do. I have a... the A3 amendment, which moves the we're going to skip that one, so I'm going to do an oral amendment that deletes section 3, 4, and 11. And you'll find those page section 3 and 4 on page 2 and 3. And that has to do with the snowmobile registrations. We haven't come to agreement on that language yet. And also Section 11, which you will find at the end of the bill, the last page, which is 6. And that has to do with a management plan, includes some provisions, hunting, fishing, and trapping on line 6.9. And the reason for deleting that is I don't want any bill leaving a committee that has anything to do with trapping or anything that would have to do with firearms, although this isn't specific to firearms, but that has to do with trapping. So my motion is, Mr. Chairman, to delete Sections 3, 4, and 11 from the bill.
And 2?
Yes. So let me restate that motion. Section 2, which is found on page 1, Section 3 and 4, which are found on page 2 and 3, Section 5, that is found on page 3, delete, and then Section 11, which is found on page 6.
Okay, thank you, Representative Dill. Representative Dill has a oral amendment to delete those sections. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? None opposed.
I just, Mr. Chairman, I really enjoyed that because it's everything that Mr. Meyer wanted.
Yeah, the amendment's adopted. Go ahead, Representative Dill.
I'm going to turn this over to Mr. Meyer, and he can explain the very small balance of the rest of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. This was the department's technical bill. No, I'm just teasing. So the bill that we have before you was the DNR's technical bill. Section 1 deals with other power-driven mobility devices, Segways, powered wheelchairs, things like that. This gives us the authority to establish these procedures through commissioner's order to meet the ADA requirements of the federal government. So as these ADA requirements change, this will allow us to internally change our commissioner's order rather than go through the full Chapter 14 rulemaking process. Commissioner's orders have the same effect in directing these activities on the lands and activities within the state of Minnesota. Section 2, we've deleted. Section 3, 4, and 5 dealt with. Section 2 dealt with OHV criminal penalties with the Apprentice Rider Program. There's no penalty established for that right now. We're bringing that in, but we've taken that out because of other complications with that language. Sections 3, 4, and 5 dealt with the establishment of a non-trail snowmobile license. Last year, the snowmobile trail pass and the registration were combined. We're still in negotiations with MinUSA on this language, so the author decided to take that out rather than leave this in here at this point in time. Section, so that will bring us to page 4, which is section 6 of the bill. This section is extending the Matthew Lowry Trail, the terminus, the southerly terminus of it, from that currently ended in the St. Croix State Forest to the Tsingwatana State Forest. There's more trail that continues past the St. Croix. We're just trying to continue that trail to the Tsingwatana State Forest in Pine County. Section 7 requires that allows that a state park permit is not required on the non-day use or camping, in the park developed campground or the day use area. So there's hiking, hunting pieces of this Lake LaSalle State Rec area. You will not need a state trails pass or state parks pass to be on those pieces of the land. Section 8 is actually language that was, it is in a bill carried by Representative Dabney in the House. This is just a technical correction dealing with federal disabled permits, park permits, making them to conform with the state park permits. It's a piece that we forgot to do on the House floor last year. Section 9 establishes a duplicate cross-country ski pass of $2. This was in a section of rule that the department is deleting or repealing, so rather than do a new rule, we're bringing this piece into statute. Section 10 deals with non-resident wildlife rehabilitation permits. Basically, we're allowing non-resident professional wildlife rehabilitators that have a federal rehabilitation permit
to come into the state to clean up an oil spill. If we ever have an oil spill, this will allow non-residents who are certified to come in the state and help us clean loons or whatever might be ducks on there. Section 12 deals with that provision. It just allows us to use a good faith rulemaking clause, good clause exemption in rules to conform with Section 10 of the statute so we don't have to go through the Chapter 14 process. And Section 13 also relates to rulemaking. It deals with paddle boards. It's the latest kind of craze out there. They're big, long, flat things, and saying you don't need to have your MN0042 boat number on there, so nobody would see them anyway. So we're just allowing rules to deal with that situation as well.
Mr. Meyer, if you and I were on a, Mr. Chairman, if you were on that, one of those paddle boards, you and I, that would be underwater.
That would be a big paddle board.
Mr. Chairman?
All right.
I wanted to just comment on the sections that were deleted regarding the snowmobile language, the registration language. The discussion is coming from the legislation that was passed last year that combined everything into one trail pass, registration, and all of that into one item. And so we're working on the language. You can expect to see something back in the bill at another point when we've worked out the language between my senator, who insisted on not having it that way, but we won that argument, and now he's really insisting, as he's the majority leader in the other body, and if I want to get anything passed, I'm going to have to deal with him. So we will be working on that. And beyond that, I want to make a motion, Mr. Chairman, to amend to House File 731, House File 813 that we just passed as amended into House File 731. So that would be my motion.
Okay, Representative Dill has a motion on the floor. Any discussion? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Mm. None opposed? One opposed?
Okay.
Motion passes.
I'm ready to answer questions, Mr. Chairman.
Members of the committee, are there any questions of Representative Dill or Mr. Meyer? Is there anyone in the audience this evening that would like to address this issue?
Oh, we got the game in two.
Is there anyone in the audience?
You want not snow? You want to
Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis. I'm representing the Minnesota Elk Breeders Association as I sit before you today. And I want to thank Mr. Meyer and Representative Dill in working with us. In the original bill, House File 742, as introduced, contained some language dealing with the taking and recapturing of agricultural animals that have escaped in this state. We had some concerns about that. We voiced them to Mr. Bogus and Mr. Meyer at the Department of Natural Resources.
One moment, please. I'm given to understand that you may be talking about the wrong bill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman, since he's up here, can we just have him comment on the next bill up, and then we'll have that over with?
Representative Dill, certainly. Go right ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I beg your apologies because this bill is up at the exact same time right now over in the Senate. And so I'm trying to do both, and I apologize for you for coming in and doing that. But in the next bill that's going to come up, House File 742, I want to thank Mr. Meyer and Mr. Bogus for removing the original language that we objected to. In the DE2 that you'll see, there is a Section 40 in there that references the department working with the Board of Animal Health, Minnesota Farm Survey Advisory Committee, and reporting back to the legislature. We just think that the Minnesota Elk Breeders Association has committed to the Department of Natural Resources to talk about and discuss this issue. We think the correct venue to do that is the Farm Survey Advisory Committee, and it is of our opinion that we don't need language to do that. I'm reading that into the tape right now and giving my commitment to Mr. Meyer, Representative Dill, and to you that we will work this process through the Farm Survey Advisory Committee. Okay. Mr. Chairman, thank you for your time, and I apologize for commenting on the previous bill rather than the one I wanted.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to address Bill number 731? Any further comments or discussion from the committee? Representative Dill, would you renew your motion, please?
And I will. I'd like to renew that House File 731 as amended be recommended to pass and move to government operations.
All right. Representative Dill has renewed his motion. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Opposed. Motion passes.
To where?
Next on the agenda this evening is House File 742, Representative Dill.
Hi, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to make the motion to move House File 732, recommend to pass and re-referred to, or 742, I'm sorry, and re-referred to government operations. And this, members, is the Game and Fish Bill. There's a delete all amendment. As soon as the bill is before us, I will then do the delete all amendment.
Okay, Representative Dill, the bill is before us. Would you like
Thank
to...
You. Yes, I'd like to move the 742DE2 amendment. It's a delete all amendment that will replace the original bill.
Okay, thank you, Representative Dill. We have the amendment before us. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? None opposed?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and I'll ask Mr. Meyer to come and explain these sections. Oh, Ms. Don Carlos to come down, and we'll start with, obviously, section one. Wherever this says BM means, not
mine. Mr. Chair, Committee, thank you. Kathy Don Carlos, DNR Division of Fish and Wildlife Deputy Director. Thanks for hearing this bill tonight. I'll walk you through the sections, starting with Section 1. This is a provision that is just really a technical clarification. This section of statute has to do with expedited rulemaking, and we're just proposing to add clarification for the reason we use expedited rulemaking versus emergency rulemaking, and that is specifically to address season variables on an annual basis. This is information we don't have until after the following season is completed, so it's a very time-sensitive, tight timeline type of situation. Section 2 has to do with us enacting or carrying out the Federal American with Disabilities Act. Mr. Meyer had talked about this section in the previous bill. It's the same exact rationale. We're just looking for the ability to use commissioner orders to actually implement the American Disabilities Act on lands that the state has jurisdiction over. Section 3 deals with providing the ability for the commissioner to issue licenses to people that are critically or gravely ill. This is something that we don't have statute authority for now. We do it on a very limited basis. We're just proposing to actually codify an approach that would take advantage of existing organizations who are already working with critically ill or gravely ill people. Basically a technical fix. Sections 4, 5, and 6 all have to do with clarifying rice boats or waterfall boats, waterfall seasons. We've done a review of the statutes, and we find that we haven't defined rice boat, which is what Section 4 does. And Sections 5 and 6, often in the statutes, we refer to duck boats or duck seasons. And because geese are also included in that, this is just a technical fix, replacing duck with waterfall wherever it appears. Section 7, again, is the same thing. It's just a continuation of replacing duck
boat duck season with waterfall boat waterfall season. Again, the same thing applies in Section 8, 9, and 9. So you can see those are just technical cleanup sections. Section 10 has to do with cooperative farming agreements. This is an arrangement that we currently use on wildlife management areas, scientific and natural areas. And we're proposing to also add aquatic management areas to this section of statute. This is a very useful tool for us to work with neighboring landowners or nearby landowners to help manage lands on WMAs, SNAs, and then we hope AMAs if this provision passes. Section 11 has to do with, it's actually an enforcement related section, and I'm just looking at our enforcement staff to see if they want to carry this or if you would like me to.
Keep coming down.
Okay, I'm not deputized to talk about enforcement. So.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. Would you please state your name for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lieutenant Colonel Rodman Smith, Assistant Director for Enforcement. Section 11, Mr. Chair and members, is to clarify that when a person's license is seized, when the restitution value of the violation is over $500, that the license seizure is for all those same types of wild animals that can be taken. An example is there is a couple different cases in the past couple of years where somebody has illegally taken a deer, and it's a rather large trophy deer, one of those community deer that everybody knows about. So the individual is tagged for that, their firearms license is seized, and what's happened is the very next day they'll go out with their archery license and arrow another deer of same or similar size, and it's very frustrating. The language under line 5.12 says that you can't, current language says you can't obtain a license to take a similar. What we're doing is we're saying that if you already have a license, so if you already had an archery license and you weren't playing by the rules with your firearms license, that you can't use then that archery license. So then the sections lines 5.14 to 5.17 just reaffirm that if you have a violation for taking deer, you can't get another license to take deer in that same season. It also says for small game, if you have a violation with the forfeiture that's over $500, you couldn't use any other small game license during that seizure period as well. For small game, the license seizure to get to $500 usually involves some type of trapping. It's pretty rare to get a $500 seizure limit or a $500 restitution value on small game, but it does occur every once in a while.
Thank you for your testimony. All right, let's go to the committee and Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In this new language, I'm curious to know, let's say that the violation occurs during bear hunting, and I don't know if it's possible to get over $500, and that's considered, is that considered, first of all, what's considered to be big game in Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, big game would be defined as deer, elk, moose, bear, so the big game animals.
Representative Fabian.
Can't think of them all.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question becomes, because it's not clear to me, if this violation occurs when hunting bear, which is a big game, does that preclude the person from going deer hunting later on?
Mr. Chair.
Colonel Smith.
Representative Fabian, yes, it would preclude them from deer hunting later in that season.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this the intention of the author of the bill?
Colonel Smith.
No.
Well,
author.
Yeah, author of the bill.
Oh.
Yeah. thank you, Mr. Chair. The answer is yes. I feel strongly that if you are a violator and you get this kind of restitution, at least for that season, you should no longer be able to take big game. And I think that's what Lieutenant Colonel Smith is stating.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Colonel Smith, then let's just say that somebody was successful in acquiring an elk license in the special permit areas up in the northwest part of the state, and that person then was deemed as ineligible to use that license. Would you fill that extra license in with somebody else in the drawing?
Colonel Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I don't believe we would. I'd have to defer to my wildlife counterparts. It depends on when the violation happened. If there was enough time then to get somebody in there, I don't see why we would have an issue with that, but I'm going to defer to our wildlife staff.
Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fabian, I think we're going to have to get back to you on that. I think there are situations where that we can't fill a license that's been drawn that quickly. But before I answer that definitively, I really want to double check on that. But I think it's no, we can't, but we need to get back to you.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I know somebody who would appreciate that. So,
do you want to go ahead? With anything further from the committee? Any no. questions? Anyone in the audience?
I need to continue with the bill, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dill, sorry.
So Section 12 is has to do with disabled veterans who get, this is a Representative Anderson bill that was heard on February 13, 2013, and it was a bill that was laid over for possible inclusion. I've included it. It allows for a person to get proof, permanent proof in a card that would allow them to show at a license agent and get a essentially a free deer hunting license, which they can already get if they're 100% disabled. But what has to happen is they come with a doctor's permission. People aren't prepared to understand at the IGA store in Orr what all of that means. But if they come with a card and it says, you know, permanently disabled, they'll get that. And then Section 13 is the same thing for veterans, Sarah Anderson, Representative Anderson bill, except with relative to small game. So there's really no change in the law. It's about being able to identify, and this is a very, very small pool of people, and I might ask Ms. Don Carlos if she has an idea of how many people we'd be talking about.
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, committee members, we have about 2,100 100% disabled military veterans that obtain a deer license under this provision, and this would allow them now to have two options. They could continue to take their paperwork to any agent in the state and have that free license issued, or they could have their paperwork reviewed in St. Paul, certified, and then issued a card that says that they are qualified to get this license, and actually provides instructions to the ELS agent on which screens and which options to choose. So it's different than what we talked about before, but we think it will cover everyone, and it will allow them to have an option of which way they want to go, which option they want to choose. So it should make it a lot easier.
And, Ms. Chairman, the department has indicated to me that they are going to absorb the cost, any cost on this, so it wouldn't require a fiscal note on that portion. Okay. And then, are there any, I'd be willing to answer any questions if there are any on Section 12 and 13.
Thank you, Representative Dill. Are there any questions of the committee on Sections 12 and 13?
Okay, then, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Don Carlos will go ahead with Section 14.
Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Section 14 is a technical correction. By oversight, our Take a Kid Ice Fishing Weekend did not provide for an adult not to need a spearing license if they were using that activity with a youth. So that this section addresses that. In addition, it also allows the commissioner to prescribe by written order the actual date of Take a Kid Ice Fishing or Take a Kid Fishing. This models language that the commissioner already has authority to use for creating special days in state parks. So this will actually reduce the rulemaking portion of this and give us a lot more flexibility.
Section 15, again, is a technical fix. Last year we had license fee increases reviewed and passed, which we're very appreciative. When the dust settled, there were a few things that we found that had been overlooked, and one of them was for residents age 16 or 17. In the current statute, there's no provision for those youth actually taking fish by spearing. So this is a technical correction to correct that. Section 16, there's a number of sections that have to do, I'm going to describe it first and then I'll identify the sections. But again, when the dust settled last year after we did our license fee increases, we found that we were treating non-resident youth differently than resident youth. We're very interested in leveling the playing field, and so we're proposing that the same fees that we have for resident youth, for big game hunting, small game hunting, turkey hunting, are the same for non-residents as well. So sections 16, 17, 18, and 18 all make that adjustment. In addition, I'm going to skip over section 19 for a second because section 20 has to do with this leveling the playing field and clarifying the language. Section 20 simply codifies what we're implementing but don't have statute language for. I think, again, this is just an oversight. The statute language for youth is very, very complicated, and we try to make it as simple as possible. So adding those sections 19 through 22 in this section, again, just puts in language what we've understood our authority to be. I did want to... Section 19, if we can go skip back to section 19. Again, when the dust settled after the license fee increase, we found that we did not have adequate language to allow non-resident youth to take fish by spearing. And so just for ages 16 and 17. So again, this is a technical fix. And my apologies. The license increases, the review and the language that was put together for that last year was just incredible, but there were a few things that we did miss. In that vein, Section 21 has to do with our super sports license. This was a new license last year, and we did not catch that when the DNR proposal for angling licenses was not adopted, but another fee was identified. We did not correct that in the super sports license. And super sports is basically a sports license with a number of other tags and licenses. And so what this provision is doing is actually just making sure that the price for the super sports license is the same as the total for the other licenses sold individually. Right now, they're more in statute, and that's not a deal. So that was not our intent.
Okay. Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. Any questions of the committee at this point? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We had some, Deputy Director Don Carlos, we had some discussions at one of the Mohawk gatherings at noon about taking the trout portion out of that super sport license. Did you have any discussions regarding that? And then making an adjustment in the cost.
Deputy Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, we did go back and review that. Representative McNamara at the Mohawk Caucus had a question. Why would we include trout stamp as a feature of the super sports license? Why not the walleye stamp? And we sell about 89,000 trout stamps, and we sell just a few thousand walleye stamps. And so we felt that there are more people, and I've actually got the information, and I can share that. But we have more people. We have far more people that buy these four licenses, or three or four additional options, in addition to their sports license. And we can see 12,000 of those license purchasers already have a trout license, where less than 1,000 have the walleye stamp. So we did look at it. We looked at it very seriously, but it still seems to make sense that the super sports license will be more attractive to someone who has a trout stamp than a walleye stamp. We did think also that we really need to test this, so we would like to implement this change, look at sales for 1 or 2 years, and then come back and make adjustments. This is a new license for Minnesota, and we've got a little bit to learn about it. So we would propose that we approach it that way, and then make adjustments after we see what the sales patterns are.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just to that point then, maybe we need to take a look in the future at breaking it down by your districts around the state. Quite frankly, in my part of the state, there aren't any. Well, there's one trout stream that I know of, but there's lots of other opportunities. And, you know, by breaking it out that way, you might be able to sell more of those. But just a comment.
All right. Deputy Director, continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Section 22 is a change for agents selling licenses. Current statutes have various license fees with no rationale for why they're $1 in some cases and 50 cents in other cases. So we're proposing that all of the issuing fees be the same regardless of what species or what type of license it is. And those are being increased to $1. This is we've gotten feedback from license agents asking about that. So if no questions, I'll move on to Section 23.
Mr. Chair.
General Smith.
Section 23 deals with the trespass statute, and what this is intended to do is, if you read the language, it says a person may not remain on any land. We're asking to have the word return, because what we're seeing is with the proliferation of especially coyote hunters, if a landowner goes out and tells people, you're on my property, I want you to leave, then they leave. If they come back, the county attorneys have told us that we can't charge them. They're not remaining on the property. So every time they come back, the landowner has to tell them to leave. So this is giving the landowner the opportunity to say, please stay off my land and don't come back. And then if the people do come back later that day, we will be able to do something with them other than having the landowner have to continuously to ask them to leave their property.
Representative Purcell.
General. Thank you, Ms. General, if that question is appropriate. But are you talking about posted land?
Mr. Chair, it'd be for unposted land or posted land. Or I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell, it'd be for unposted land, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Dill.
But thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with this Section 23, but also it could be posted land, but there are also lands that are open to the public, forested lands that don't need to be posted. Is that correct? And if so, if the owner went out and told them that it's not posted because it's not agricultural, it's forested lands, then they would have to leave.
That
Colonel Smith?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct.
11 years on this committee, I'm starting to learn a thing or two.
All right, continue, please.
Mr. Chair, Section 24 is somewhat of a technical correction. It's actually given our officers and the county attorneys the ability to charge somebody with a misdemeanor rather than having to charge them with a gross misdemeanor. Under current law, there's in 97A315, a person that violates the trespass statute as currently written in this area, where they remain on privately posted land after being told to leave, they have to be charged with a gross misdemeanor. And what we've done here on lines 2.1 to, or to, excuse me, 12.1 to 12.4 is basically breaking into two sections, so it allows the officer and the county attorney to charge somebody with a lesser offense, which would be a misdemeanor. So it's just a little bit of a technical correction, gives our officers a little few more tools. Section 25 is somewhat of a technical correction dealing with the term, removing the term legal. In Game and Fish Law, guardian is defined, and it talks about legal guardian or somebody else. The problem was some county attorneys were saying that since the term legal was in front of legal guardian, that it's a different term than just guardian, so they were taking it as legal guardian and not just guardian. So we want to remove the term legal to clarify that the term guardian as defined in Game and Fish Law is what the legislative intent was. Section 26 is allowing non-residents to participate in the hunter apprentice hunter program, and where this comes about is there are many folks who have grandchildren that come back to the state. They want to come out and hunt, so they're technically non-residents, so they could participate in the hunter apprentice program. Last year there was some disabled vets from Wisconsin that wanted to participate in a special disabled vet turkey hunt, but they did not have firearm safety didn't meet our firearm safety requirements, so at that point they could have participated in this program as well. So it's just extending that to non-residents. Part C on page 13, line 13.3 to line 13.8, is clarifying that the person that is the person that is acting as the mentor has to have a valid license for the same time period. So specifically to turkeys, if you were going to be a mentor, you'd have to have a turkey license for the fall, but if you were going to mentor a hunt for the C season, you wouldn't have to have a C license. You could have an A, B, or a D license. You just had to have a turkey license valid for the fall turkey season. And same with prairie chickens. Section 27, there's actually two parts to this. This is the first part of, this has been brought forward by a stakeholder group, and we worked with the stakeholder group on this. And this is related to bow fishing. A sport that's really taken off in the state. And when bow fishing first started, you couldn't transport an uncased bow in a motor vehicle. And so what happened was when this first came about, it was decided that they would allow the uncased bow to be transported in a battery-operated or basically a trolling motor boat. Well, with the proliferation of the sport, people moving to other waters, especially some of the rivers where there's some fast-moving water, we agree that they should be allowed to use motorized watercraft to exercise the sport just for the safety of it. And then,
keep going, Colonel.
Okay, and then, Mr. Chair, Section 28, I believe, was already heard in committee. That was with the Representative Dill's bill.
I just want you to know that this it goes against my grain to give a conservation officer a tape measure, but this particular provision may require it.
All right.
Any questions of the committee at this point in time? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dill, just so I'm clear on the 144 square inches of blaze orange material that's visible from all directions around the blind, are there any requirements on what the material must be?
Representative Dill.
Ms. Chairman and Representative Fabian, that would be no.
Representative Fabian.
And just so I'm clear, the 144 is the total square inches of all four sides, not 144 inches per side, but a total of the four sides.
Representative Dill.
No, Mr. Chairman. It is 144 square inches. That would be 12 by 12, right, on each side. Is that correct? 112 times 12?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
That's correct.
Yep. And, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dill.
And Representative Fabian, if you have served on a conference committee, you'll know why this is in the bill.
Thank you.
All right. Deputy Director.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee. Continuing on with Section 29, over the last several years, the agency is finding themselves being requested by more and more adults who are interested in learning how to hunt. And our current statutes allow us to establish special hunts for youth. We'd like to drop that reference to just youth and expand it to youth and adults in support of our recruitment and retention activities. Section 30 is linked with Section 37. The point of these two sections is to help us make our rules for use of bait in Lake Superior consistent with aquatic invasive species statutes. Basically, what this is doing is specifying that eggs taken from fish on Lake Superior can be used on Lake Superior or the tributaries below the posted boundaries. It also clarifies that eggs can be used for angling on Lake Superior if they come from certified handlers to make sure that they're disease-free. These two sections make these changes in statutes and rule using good cause clause. Sections 31, 32, and 33 have to do with allowing spearing to occur slightly earlier than had otherwise been provided. So you can see in Section 33 that the time period for taking suckers by spearing would begin the last Saturday in April rather than in May 1st, I believe it is. And as I understand the other two statutes, that language just then supports that intent, which is the purpose of the changes in the three sections.
One moment. Representative Cornish has a question.
Representative Dill, this one I'm not going to make a big fuss about, but one of the big things, I don't know, for none of you that have lived north of 210, sucker spearing is huge up in the area in the north. And when the suckers run, May 1st was a blessed day because it was one of the few days besides a snow day that you would get off from school in Northome. The school that my kids went to, northeast of Bemidji, when May 1st came, they would call off school because so many kids were out spearing fish that it didn't even pay to have school. And we'd camp out the night before, wake up, start spearing suckers, and we'd pickle suckers for several days. But this opens it on a Saturday. That's probably good reasons for it, but your education, the people from education didn't have anything to do with this because it was a school day they were missing, was it?
Unions, Tony. It's the unions.
No, not unions, but school boards. And
Representative Dill, can't we help out Representative
Hopefully
Cornish?
Hopefully this is a wildlife issue here.
Well, Representative Cornish, no. I have not heard from anyone except the bow fishermen on this issue.
Okay. I'm going to miss that.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman,
Representative,
you can still have that blessed day up there if you like. You just have to pick the day that you normally went and let everybody else go first.
Okay. Deputy Director, continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I did want to acknowledge Representative Dill reminded me that we have been talking over the last several months with the spearing groups and also the bow fishing groups to make these changes. So I did want to acknowledge that there was collaboration in this, and I think the groups worked directly with you on sections 31 to 33. 34. Section 34 has to do with opening the bow fishing season earlier, but just for the part of the state that falls south of State Highway 210. And it would be confined to bow fishing from a boat and only from lakes or the three major rivers, Mississippi, Minnesota, or St. Croix rivers. And we were in dialogue for quite a long time over this one and definitely support this section. Section 35 is just a complimentary section that supports moving the bow fishing season to make sure that possession of bows and bow fishing equipment is compatible with these new times. Section 36, I'm not sure if Lieutenant Colonel, did you talk about?
Mr. Chair.
Lieutenant Colonel.
Section 36 is again what deals with the bull fishing and with the proliferation of technology. Line 16.18 says that they had to use a four-stroke motor. There are motors out there that are E-Tech now that are much quieter, so it doesn't make any sense to restrict them anymore to what type of motor they have to use. So that, like, that language is being struck. They still have to have the 65 decibels, so that just seemed burdensome, undue burdensome to them. And then striking the language in 16.22 to 16.24 is that it's a test that we don't use, because really no boat could ever pass that test, and it's a very cumbersome test to use to measure the sound. There are other sound tests that we do use, and we've worked in consultation with the boat fishing folks and some of the county sheriffs that also do noise enforcement. We're all in agreement that striking this language would do no one harm to anybody else. So, and then lines 16.25 to 16.28 are basically just technical language is related to that stuff.
Thank you. Deputy Director, did you want to continue?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I believe we've already covered Section 37. It has to do with that use of fish eggs on Lake Superior. And now I'd like to hand the envelope to Lieutenant Colonel Smith.
Back, Chair. Section 38 is establishing through the rulemaking process a restitution value for sandhill cranes. We do have restitution values for just about every wild animal. A few years back, there was a sandhill crane season in place. There was no restitution value on sandhill cranes, and so we're just establishing a restitution value for sandhill cranes. Then Section 39, again, is to deal with the early bull fishing and spearing. Section 35 and 36 is this, oh, I'm sorry, I went backwards here, I'm sorry. 39,
let's go to 40.
It's getting late, I apologize, Mr. Chair. Section 40 has to deal with the Farm Survey Aid report, which I believe a testifier testified on the previous bill about. And this was, I believe, something that DNR worked out to do a report about the escapes and give it to the ranking chairs. Section 41 is just technical to have the revisor replace the word waterfall boat or duck boat appears in rule. And then we do have the repealers in Section 42.
And the repealers are the repealing a ban on returning carp and buffalo taken in netting back to the water. Mr. Meyer, I think, or are you going to explain that? And then also, before Ms. Don Carlos explains that, included in is as a repealer, which was actually House File 657, is there was a ban on spear fishing or possessing a spear on 8 different lakes, and Representative Hackbar's bill, which was House File 657, heard in this committee on February 26th, is being incorporated into the bill, which would eliminate that ban on the 8 lakes.
Very good. Deputy Director.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the repeal language for 97C.346, this is kind of a story. This is a complicated story. But back in 2010, this section was repealed. The bill passed, and for technical reasons, the bill was vetoed, but it was the intent to pass this bill with this language. 97C.346 actually prohibits the return of carp or buffalo taken by netting, and we have about 30 commercial harvesters that get licenses to harvest using nets, And there are times when they'll pull their nets and there'll be a substantial number of game fish mixed with rough fish. And the way the law is currently written, they can't return that net to the water to release the game fish. They've got to take the whole haul. And so the intent back in 2010 was to drop this language. And again, because of how the bill did not survive, we lost that. So we'd like to go back and drop that because that's not what the intent is. The other Representative Dill mentioned the final phrase in the repealer language has to do with the rules of removing spearing restrictions on eight lakes, and the agency is fine with the seven lakes. We can live with the eighth lake spearing restriction taken off, but we request that we'd like to retain that spearing restriction until we can finish transitioning between, and I think Chief Peterson talked about this 2 weeks ago, to allow us time to transition between two different strains of muskie. It's not a must-have. It would be a nice-to-have to allow staff to finish that transition. In addition, we're meeting with, we are in dialogue with the Dark House Association and are looking at other lakes to add to this list of seven or eight, however that turns out.
And, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Dill.
If you'll remember, when we heard House File, the Hackbarth House File, 657, the DNR did testify they were fine with seven, and the eighth lake was still in question, and we're going to go ahead and move the bill forward into government operations. We're still working on that one, on the eighth lake.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Dill.
And also, Mr. Chairman, before we go to questions on the bill, I'd like to move an amendment to the bill as amended, and that would be move that House File 717, which was the Purcell bill, be amended to House File 742 as amended.
Okay, Representative Dill has a motion on the floor for an amendment. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? None opposed? Motion carries. Representative Dill, anything else?
Nothing. Questions from the members or from the audience? We'll do our very best to answer them.
Representative Cornish.
For Ms. Don Carlos, the used to be that we ran into a real problem with the walleye run running right up to the spearing of the suckers. And did you leave yourself any leeway in rulemaking authority that if it's just plugged with walleyes on the last Saturday that you can keep that back, or are you comfortable with just letting them go at it? And
Deputy Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, we did look at the dates. We are seeing the dates for walleye runs moving up in time by 3 or 4 days. We're comfortable with this language. We also have the ability to close areas to angling to protect spawning runs, and that's a tool that we can use if there are problems and there's conflict. But we're hoping there won't be. But we think we have tools to deal with it.
Mr. Chairman?
It probably is a good thing, actually, because I remember a lot of times on May 1st, the run had already started long by and before that and just full of suckers, and everybody was frustrated. They couldn't get out there, so a week early wouldn't probably be a bad thing.
Representative Dill.
And did I hear you, Ms. Don Carlos, say that you have the rulemaking authority to close an area in case there's a conflict? Like, for example, at the Vermilion Gorge, you close that to angling during the walleye run. Because it happens, the walleye run happens during the beginning of the angling season, but wouldn't you still have the same authority to close a specific area if on an emergency basis if the place was flooded with walleye up there and you knew about it?
Deputy Director?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, yes.
Thank you.
All right. Any questions from the committee at this point in time? Hearing none, we'll go to the Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, we heard from Mr. Quillis on the farm survey issue, and he represents the elk breeders, and I know that there's folks in the audience from the deer folks, too. And, you know, this Minnesota Farm Survey Advisory Committee, this is exactly what they do. This is why they get together. They work out these kind of differences. This language that's in the bill here is really not needed. So with that, Mr. Chairman and Representative Dill, if you don't mind, I'm going to make a motion to delete Section 40.
And Mr. Chairman?
Representative Dill.
I am agreeable with that amendment.
Okay, we have, was that Section 40? 44?
Section 40.
40. Okay, we have an amendment, the oral amendment from Representative Hackbarth to delete Section 40 from the bill. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None opposed? Motion carries. Any further comments? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dill, under the rulemaking on page 17, Section 38, the restitution value for a sandhill crane at $200. Can you give me some enlightenment as to how we chose the number $200? I've seen a lot of sandhill cranes. And
Mr. Chairman?
And I'd like...
And
I'd also like to find out, so if someone does get caught shooting a sandhill crane, what's the total fine going to be, including the restitution?
Representative Dill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I think Lieutenant Colonel Smith will address this, but I'd ask that if 200 is too much, that Representative Fabian give us a number.
Thank you. Lieutenant Colonel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, the wildlife restitution value for sandhill crane and how we came to $200. I do have a file, if you'd like to go through it. We looked through other states. We had a study done back in the 80s about what the value should be, and we looked at other animals. We looked at the fact that the sandhill cranes can only be hunted in the northwestern part of the state because that's a different flyway than the central flyway, and the central flyway has a different kind of crane. And so looking at all that, you know, $200, you'd have to shoot three of them in order to get into a gross over limit situation where a license would be seized or anything like that. So $200 was pretty consistent with the other restitution values that we have right now in the state. As to answer your question about if one was taken illegally, I guess it depend on the violation that the person was cited for and how they took that illegally. If they took it without a license, it would probably be a base fine of, I think that's $70, but then you have to add in all the court costs and law library fees, so you're looking at about $160 for the fine and then whatever the restitution value is on top of that. A wild turkey, for example, is about $200 right now as well.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative,
all of those fees and fines and library fees are Representative Rukavina fees that he loves so much.
Okay. There you go. Well, we must be okay then. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If the author of the bill is looking for a new number, I would suggest dropping the zero, but I don't know that I'll get a lot of support for that. But
Mr. Chairman.
And you can pick either zero to drop, too. I don't care which one.
Representative Dill.
I'm not amenable to that particular amendment.
Okay. Representative Fabian.
And one last thing. This is just a comment, folks. I've been here for a little over 2 years, and I have talked a lot about the size of the books, and thank you, Deputy Director Don Carlos, for the rule books that you brought to my office the other day. I appreciate that. Question for you, Deputy Director. In this bill and the things that we're doing, have we made this any smaller outside of making the print smaller, maybe moving some pictures? The rules are so vastly complex. I hear it over and over and over again from sportsmen and women who go hunting, who go fishing, who are so frustrated with the myriad of rules. Please tell me what you've done in this bill that makes this book smaller.
Deputy Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, you caught me flat-footed with that question. I do want to say, because I'm going to think about it while I'm, yep. I'm going to double-track here, but we don't like complicated, difficult-to-understand regulations either. We don't want people that hunt and fish and trap to be lawbreakers. And so we try, through the regulation book, to translate statute and rule into more common language. We just started a new process. We were pulling a group together to look at the hunting regulations to see if we can simplify things through layout. We're constantly looking at how to simplify content. So that's an ever-present objective of ours, and we're very open to suggestions about how to make it simpler.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your indulgence. and my apologies to the committee. This is kind of a an important topic for me, and so much of what is in here is not even known by some of the managers in the area. I had discussions with the horse owners in my area. I asked one of the wildlife managers, I said, so how many permits have you issued to horse owners to travel on WMAs with their horses? And he said, well, I can't do that. And I said, well, in the book it's on page 104 under WMAs, and he said, I didn't know that. Well, I listened to a radio call-in show the week before the deer hunting season this fall in northwestern Minnesota, and it was a great thing to do because they had one of the conservation officers come in and field questions from the deer hunters. Well, I listened to it for about 15 or 20 minutes. There were five or six different deer hunters that called in asking questions about what happens if this happens. And four of the cases, the conservation officer said, well, I'm going to have to get back to you on that. And I appreciate the fact that the conservation officer said offline, get your phone number to us and we'll get back to you. My point is that these things are so complicated that the conservation officers and the wildlife managers don't know what the rules are for sure. How do we expect sportsmen to know what the rules are? So that's just an editorial comment, and I would certainly appreciate the DNR putting a group of people together to make these rule books smaller and more understandable. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fabian. Representative Johnson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I just want to make that a bipartisan or nonpartisan issue. I agree with you.
Thank you.
I really believe in principle and the simplicity and clarity of rules and regulations. I use those books. I'm confused by them as well. Please try and make them simpler. Thank you.
Boy. Representative,
I got to talk to my friend. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Fabian. Yeah, it got out of hand when they got away from thou shalt not steal, right? I mean,
there you go. Thank you. Representative Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I were a representative from Kitson County and Roseau County, I would have a one-page document that explained how things work. But, I mean, Minnesota is complicated, and I have to tell you that, all of you know, I'm an outfitter in Canada, a fishing and hunting outfitter, and do you know that the ministry has now decided not to print the books at all? And so when someone comes, Representative Ugham, like you come me. To my resort last summer, I could not give you a book even though you bought a license. You have to go online and figure it out. So, I mean, this is a huge cost-saving issue up there, apparently, for them. Right now we can get the hunting regulations, but we can only get 100 books.
And it's a little tough to go online in certain areas of Canada.
So, I mean, this is a really complicated thing, but we've got a complicated state. Now, in some instances, counties are different than, I mean, a county in the north and a county in the south got a whole different ball game. So,
okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to hear from the audience.
Right.
And then
next.
We're going to move the bill.
Okay. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to address House File 742 this evening? Oh, we have one individual. Please step to the podium. Give us your name for the record, please.
All right. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Scott Slocum. I'm a resident of White Bear Lake, Minnesota.
Go ahead with your testimony.
Go ahead, Mr. Slocum.
I'm here to testify against HF 742, not for what it does, but for what it doesn't do. I was listening online last week to a meeting of the Senate Fish and Wildlife Subcommittee. The committee was hearing the DNR agency bill, SF 796, the companion bill to this HF 742. Ms. DonCarlos talked about the need for recruitment and retention and then presented the bill, including tweaks to angling and hunting retirement recruitment programs. For example, Section 29 of this bill, and lowered fees for youth licenses. It struck me that I can't imagine these programs getting upland small game hunters back who have quit because it's not safe to take their dogs out where they might be killed by body-gripping traps. I like to do some trap shooting at the range, but I'll tell you, if I was inclined to take up hunting, none of these hunter recruitment programs would get me out in the field with a dog in Minnesota. It's just not safe, and a lot of people know that. A lot of people know what happens when a dog finds a body-gripping trap along a road or trail or in the field. It's a bad end to what should have been a good day. You could call that negative hunter retention. Here's my Minnesota version of going out shooting with your dog. First, take the dog out for a walk on the leash or in a dog park if you have one. Then you leave the dog in the car while you go shooting clay pigeons. No hunting license required, no dog dead. If the Minnesota DNR and the Minnesota legislature are really concerned about hunter recruitment and retention, then they'll need to take the lead and solve this problem. Otherwise, we should just send people to Wisconsin, where the Wisconsin DNR and Wisconsin legislature identified and solved most of this problem 14 years ago. A solution has been proposed for Minnesota, though. It's the Body Gripping Trapping Restrictions Bill, HF 456. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Slocum, for your testimony. Is there anyone on the committee that would like to address Mr. Slocum? Right. Oh, Representative Ward.
Oh, Mr. Chair, are we hearing that bill? Or
no, we are not. That bill is not before us. but this is an omnibus bill. So thank you, Mr. Slocum.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to address the committee this evening? Seeing none, Representative Dill, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, I'd like to renew my motion that House File 742, as amended, be recommended to pass, re-referred to government operations.
Okay, we have a motion on the floor. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? None opposed? Motion carries. Hearing no objection, we will adjourn for this evening. Thank you.